You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
To the best of Flashpoints for the week of March 22nd, 2019. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, we feature an interview on the history and future of the death penalty with Michael Kroll. Also, noted author Arun Kundani talks to us about how Trump's presidency has recharged the batteries of white power. And later, we take a microscopic look at the long-term criminal conspiracy formerly known as Monsanto. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We kick off today's show with an interview from Monday's program looking at the history and future of the death penalty with Michael Kroll.
You may have heard that a politician named Gavin Newsom, the governor of the most powerful state in the union, took a moral stand, stood up against the death penalty, and articulated it in a way that was honest and powerful, and it reverberated across this country. We're going to spend some time on that as we open up the show today. And I am honored to have in the studio somebody who's an old friend, Michael Kroll. We used to work together at Pacific News Service. Michael is the founder and the former executive director of Death Penalty Information Center. And he was a friend of a man by the name of Robert Alton Harris. You want to remind us, welcome, and remind us about Robert.
Sure. Thank you, Dennis. Well, you know, the death penalty in California has had its path, like every other bit of law. And in 1972, the Supreme Court of the United States found the death penalty to be unconstitutional as applied, and that was across the board. And various states came back and reenacted new statutes to try to meet the objections of the court. California's statute actually began as an initiative and then a statute, and in 1976, the death penalty was reconstituted in the United States. At that time, our method of execution was the gas chamber at San Quentin. In the course of kind of how the media reports capital punishment, which is almost always at the point of an execution, seldom the process, which is long, laborious, and requires multiple people making multiple decisions along the way, a man by the name of Robert Alton Harris rose to the top of the media's monster list, sort of the poster boy for why we need a death penalty. He had been convicted of killing two teenage boys, taking their car and robbing a bank, along with his brother. I had been writing about the death penalty for some time by that time, quite a long time, in fact, and I was interviewing a man on death row at the time who had represented himself in a trial that should not have been a death trial, but he represented himself and got a death sentence. And he continuously urged me to meet this man, Robert Alton Harris. He's not who the press says he is. He's not the slavering killer. He's not the monster. And occasionally he would come down for a visit with his lawyers, and I would look over my shoulder to see who this monster was. And he was just a young man. Finally, I agreed that I would meet with him, mainly to get this other prisoner off my back and stop poking me. And so I sent in my application as a visitor, and was accepted, and I began visiting him. And for almost 10 years, we continued to visit. He and I enjoyed each other's companies. He was not an intellectual in any way. He suffered from fetal alcohol syndrome, which levels the brain somewhat flat, though he could still beat me at dominoes every time we played. And we just enjoyed each other. I didn't delve into his life's history. I didn't write about him. I simply was with him as a friend. And I visited him mostly every week for those 10 years. At the end of that 10-year period, his case reached the top of the heap. And you have to understand that each case goes on its own course. So someone who may be behind someone else in the process may leap ahead in some other legal process. He reached the end of the line. And he got several dates of execution. Those of us who are intimately involved in the process understand that many of those dates are not real dates. They're dates that the law requires along the way. But then in the end, there are real dates. And he got one of those real dates that we thought was real. And by the grace of a very, very intelligent and very brave federal judge, he got a 2-year stay of execution on the grounds that no mental health issues were provided in his trial when he had serious mental health issues. And there was a case out of Oklahoma that dictated that he get that assistance. So he got a 2-year reprieve, basically a stay of execution, during which much of that material was introduced into court, which decided it was all too late. There's process limits. Right. And then in 1992, he got a second very serious date. And this one did not seem to be amenable to stopping. And he asked me, as his friend, I would witness his execution simply because he did not want to be hated by everyone in the room, because the families of his victims were there. Incidentally, his brother, who had actually done the shooting in this terrible crime, testified against him, his younger brother, whom he told, do what you can to save yourself. I'll take the rap, which he did. So the younger brother got served about 4 years. Robert got the death penalty.
The shooter served 4 years.
That's right. The shooter served 4 years testifying against his older brother.
This is criminal justice.
Yeah, this is how it works. Yeah. And so I was there on that first execution in 25 years in California. Mind you, I had written enough about the death penalty in California that I knew the process. I knew who was behind the walls, who was pulling which switches, how it worked. I knew how the cyanide was underneath the chair that he was strapped into. Incidentally, I've cried a couple of times in this past week with the announcement and the decision by Governor Newsom. The first time was just hearing it, partly out of incredible relief because I had no idea this was in the works or could happen, and partly because people that I have loved dearly and who have worked tirelessly on this issue have died, and they were not here to see this momentous moment. And then again, when I saw the photograph of them carrying the chair out of the chamber, this green chair in which my friend was strapped and gassed to death with me watching on the other side of the glass. So that is indelibly in my memory and will never, be erased. But to see that chair being carried out was just so emotional for me. In any case, I was there. His brother, who had not seen him in many, many years, was also there. And
To witness.
And everybody else was there as either a representative of the state to witness and to take credit for this for this killing, for this homicide, or families of the victim who had a very personal and intimate reason for wanting to see this happen. I witnessed it. It was a bizarre and horrible experience in which after Robert was strapped into the chair, after a long night of repeated stays of executions and then overturning stays of executions at a higher court level and then new stays of execution on new grounds and so forth, finally he was brought into the chamber. We were brought in to witness. And just before he was to be executed, and I mean, I've read the transcripts, I mean just milliseconds, the phone rang and another court intervened to grant a stay of execution. And so he was unstrapped and taken out of the chamber. Now, I've written about this, and it's the Nation magazine actually published my version of these events. I think it was July 6th, 1992, that issue of the Nation. What was extraordinary among the many, many extraordinary things that day and that night are that he was prepared in a way that only Robert could be. He was almost like the master of ceremonies. He was nodding to people. He was apologizing to family and friends. He asked at one point, "Where is Michael?" Because he couldn't see me. We were put behind him, and I jumped down from my place and showed him that I was there, and he settled down. But after they took him out, and another couple of hours passed before finally the Supreme Court of the United States issued a kind of, a coup d'etat, which they said was, "We will entertain no further appeals. Whatever the issues are, we're closing shop. We're going home. It's done." And they very quickly took him back into the chamber and executed him in record time. That second time, though, he was beaten down. He was extremely exhausted and looked exhausted. And that kind of boyish quality that he had going in, "I'm ready, do what you have to do," had all seeped out of him. And then we have this horrible homicide that took 16 minutes to accomplish in the gas chamber. And it is something that no one should have to experience and no one should have to witness. It is a horror.
All right. And that's Michael Kroll talking about the murder, the state-sponsored murder of his friend Robert Alton Harris on death row in San Quentin. But there is, amazingly, there is good news. There's a politician in this world who had the courage and the spine to stand up for something that he believes and to articulate it in a way that made a lot of sense to a lot of people and helped a lot more understand the multi struggles, the multi levels of struggle that take place. So give us your multiple thoughts.
Yeah, they are all multiple. Because
I know you're all over this. So we're speaking with Michael Kroll, who, by the way, is the founder and former executive director of Death Penalty Information Center.
Well, the first thing to note is that Governor Newsom is not the first governor to have granted, in some measure, relief for people on death row. The governor of Illinois did it before he left office. The governor of New Mexico did it before he left office, actually more completely than this governor, because this governor is limited by his powers. He cannot grant clemency because if the person had pre-existing felonies that got him the death penalty, the majority of Supreme Court has to vote along with him. But he can grant reprieves, which is, as long as he is governor, they are not going to be executed, and that's what he did. One of the things that I think is unique about this is that it is California. California not only is kind of the trendsetter for much of the country, it also has the largest death row of all 50 states. Yes. This comes as a shock to many Californians who like to, characterize ourselves as the progressive state of California. The progressive state of California has executed many, many people and has more people on death row than any other state. So there's that, first of all. There is, of course, the fact that this does grant a reprieve to, almost 750 men, mostly men and women, who have already been sentenced to death, which is no small matter. But it also, I think, as you've alluded to, initiates a kind of discussion, a kind of delving into this issue, which we seldom see. It's usually a us versus them, you're for or you're against. I am hoping that this will initiate or prompt a deeper discussion of what it means for a criminal justice system to provide at the top this ability to select out a group of people living under your law and killing them. And it's a very select group. The number of people who qualify for the death penalty is vast. The number of people who actually get the death penalty is very small, and it's based very much on class. We have seen this last week what class can buy. You can buy your kids' way into university. The reverse of that coin is you can also buy your way out of the most serious criminal justice consequences there are. Money talks. So you will not find rich people on death row, only poor people. It also is very racist, particularly in the application of who is the victim. When the victim is white, the chances of getting the death penalty are exponentially greater than if the victim is black or brown, because we, as a society, unfortunately place a higher value on white life and generally white juries deciding what is valuable and not. It's geographically very, very unfair. The very same crime in one county, San Francisco, will not get the death penalty because it's a liberal anti-death penalty county, but that exact same crime in Riverside will get you the death penalty. How could that be a just kind of system? So it is kind of a random, capricious selection process that picks a very few that I liken to sacrifices, as in the old ancient times when, virgins were thrown into the volcano fire to please the gods. These are our, not necessarily virgins, but they are thrown in to please the body politic that for some reason needs or wants to see people executed. That part is the part that bothers me the most. It bothers me that we're doing it. It bothers me even more that it seems like a majority of my fellow Californians want us to do it, even though they don't quite understand what the it is. And when it's laid out in this is what the it is, this is what it costs, this is the actual application versus putting someone in prison for life, which is far less expensive, which is probably a far more serious consequence, because living in prison is not a nice thing. Those things hardly ever get discussed at all. And that's why I'm hoping this really courageous act by Governor Newsom will spark that discussion.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Michael Kroll, who knows more about the death penalty, thought more about this issue than anybody I have ever heard about. He is the former founder and former executive director of Death Penalty Information Center. He has written extensively and eloquently about all aspects of this struggle. And it is, just to sort of come out the other side for a moment, for balance, if you will. While this is happening here in California, you've got some prisoners who were suing the state of, was it Tennessee? I'm not sure, for the right to be executed in the electric chair. They wanted to be electrocuted rather than the three cocktail, the three whatever drug cocktail that has now been so controversial. This is a strange and crazy controversy about how to kill people.
Absolutely. And we have this long history of how we kill people, starting with the hanging and going through a variety, electric chair, the gas chamber, and firing squad. And in fact, some states, the state of Washington, as I recall, offer an option for those condemned. You can either die at the hands of a firing squad, or you can be hanged, or maybe now they've instituted a lethal injection. Each one of these so-called improvements, I am firmly of the belief that each one is designed to make those of us who are witnessing this process feel better about it. It's not at all for anyone we're killing. It is for those of us who are watching, witnessing, and experiencing this very, very cold-blooded homicide. Cold-blooded in the sense that, as I said before, it requires a myriad of very discreet decisions made by many, many people, from police to district's attorney to lower judges to appellate judges to very many people making this decision, then this decision, then this decision, then this decision, ultimately leading to what I saw in the gas chamber in 1992.
And I mean, there are so many examples. If you talk about a court considering a case in support of the electric chair,
the horrific things that have happened around use of the electric chair. Yeah. They used to call old Sparky.
Yes.
And, you know, people's heads would explode. They would, you know, melt down their shoulders like you were in a wax museum in a fire.
Yeah, eyes popped out at various times. There are various... Each method, by the way, has its own litany of horrors and things that didn't go as planned. The electric chair has many, many such. But even lethal injection, you know, for a drug addict, finding a usable vein can be a very laborious and painful sticking and re-sticking and re-sticking. And finally, I think there was one person who they finally found a vein in the bottom of his foot. Imagine that. I think one even in his scrotum, but that may just be apocryphal. I'm not sure.
How many countries now still use death penalty?
Well, it depends. In the countries we like to compare ourselves with, all of Europe has abolished the death penalty. All of South America has abolished the death penalty. Mexico has abolished the death penalty. Canada has abolished the death penalty. The countries that we now share an affinity for the death penalty are countries like Iran, Pakistan, China. These are the biggest and the United
States.
And I think the United States is in that group of five we just named. These are the biggest executioners in the world, and these are the countries that, you know, have dictators. Freedom does not exist in the sense that we know it. It may not exist here much longer as we have known it. But, yes, we are in very, very barbaric company.
Michael Kroll, again, it's good to have you in. It's always good to see you. And you're thinking about the death penalty based on your own relationship at all levels with this struggle is always incredibly enlightening. Thank you,
Dennis.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints for the week of March 22nd, 2019. My name is Mike Biggs. Up next, we feature an interview from Tuesday's program with noted author Arun Khanani, who talks about how Trump's presidency has recharged the batteries of white power.
Let's start with the latest slaughter. Maybe you want to sort of react to it in the context of now people are beginning to talk about a global movement of right-wing white extremists who are pushing for an uprising by white people and maybe even a white nation. That's more than just a nation, but in the context of the New World Order. And Trump, you want to jump in?
I mean, I think actually what's happening is we're seeing a kind of very fragmented picture and many different strands of this going on, right? So on the one hand, you have these people like the perpetrator of the shooting in Christchurch, New Zealand last week, you know, people who are carrying out individual acts of mass violence. But there's a continuum, right, to the growing success of far-right wing movements in elections in Europe, in other parts of the world. And then all of that taking place in the context of the continuing kind of ways in which white supremacy operates through state bureaucracies around the world, you know, through the killings of black people by law enforcement officers, through the immigration system and so forth. So, you know, I think we have to think about this. The big picture here is having these, you know, kind of interrelated but distinct strands to it that stretch from, you know, from the war on terror, from the immigration system, political movements like, you know, the Front National in France, for example, which seems to have been significant in this guy's personal story, through to these individual terrorists, like this guy, Brenton Tarrant, in Christchurch.
You know, this idea of a manifesto uprising, I mean, I remember going to Alabama, coming into Mississippi in 1995, and a guy by the name of Larry Shoemake had just sort of taken the downtown city there in Mississippi, filled it with weapons, and declared war on the black population in a state that had just ratified, or was just about to ratify, the anti-slavery movement. And when they went back to this guy, Larry Shoemake's house, after he had shot about 13 black people, they found a manifesto of white liberation. So this is sort of not a new story, but it certainly has tracks in the context of Trump.
Well, I mean, and I think one of the things that is different now is the way that you can see this happen through digital media, right? So you know, clearly, unfortunately, I've spent some time looking at this guy's so-called manifesto, and one of the things that's clear is that, you know, this is an internet phenomenon, right? So his references and his language reflects a particular kind of online subculture of the far right. And then there's the fact that he live streams online the violence that he's perpetrating, and the violence, you know, becomes a way for his manifesto to get read. I mean, no one would have paid any attention to it without the violence that accompanied it. So, but since then, no doubt, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have read it. So, you know, and the internet enables you to, you know, you don't have to find the manifesto in someone's room, and, you know, it enables you to release it at the time of the violence, just before it, and it will circulate very widely immediately. You know, it's very similar in that sense to what we saw in Norway in 2011 with Anders Breivik, who similarly released a long document to try and give the rationale for the massacre that he carried out in Norway that year. And what these, you know, what these manifestos are is more or less kind of copy and paste of far-right materials that they've found online, with some kind of narcissism thrown in, where the perpetrator kind of, interviews themselves. It seems to be a motif of these things. What it tells you is that the ideas that that these people are introducing as the explanation for what they're doing are not just ideas that you find in, you know, a kind of fascist fringe, but, you know, actually much more widely circulated than that. And this is what's very clear when you look at whether it's Anders Breivik, you know, from 2011, or this guy over last week. Their references are much more mainstream than you might expect. These things should be uncomfortable reading for a lot of mainstream commentators. So to give you one example, the core argument that is in the manifesto that was released on Friday is the idea that there is a declining birth rate of white people in Australia, in Europe, etc. And so there's this idea of a demographic threat. In other words, the birth rate is declining, and this is a threat to the survival of the white race. And then that is that's kind of compared to the birth rate of Muslims, which is presented as being much higher. And it's this that's seen as the core problem, because this difference drives immigration to the West and so forth. So, you know, the argument is, where has this come from? Who's made this kind of demographic argument of a kind of threat to whiteness from differences in birth rate? Well, you would have to say that, you know, mainstream figures have made this point. Niall Ferguson, kind of well-known conservative intellectual from the UK, now based in the United States, has kind of made these kind of arguments many times. Martin Amis, the British novelist, has written articles making these arguments. You know, these are mainstream figures who should be feeling very uncomfortable that their kind of racial arguments have now been attached to this act of violence. And more generally, you know, we should say that these kind of demographic arguments that seem to be core to what this guy's thinking was are kind of integral to any project of settler colonialism. You know, whether that's in the United States or Canada or Australia or New Zealand or indeed Israel. Because what you're doing when you're doing settler colonialism, when your colonial project involves not just dominating a colonized people, but actually trying to replace them demographically, then of course the question of how many are there of you compared to how many are there of the other group becomes central to your politics. So in a way, this guy is a product of a long history of settler colonialism in Australia and New Zealand.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Arun Kundnani. He is the author of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. And he wrote a recent article called Recharging the Batteries of Whiteness, Trump's New Radical Identity Politics. Now, this will not be the first mass murderer, sort of white supremacist who cites in one way or another Donald Trump as an inspiration. He was a little, he had a little bit of a critique in his support of Trump. But do you want to talk about the role that Trumpism is playing? I mean, this ain't new for the world, but he certainly gives this all an interesting spin.
Well, like everyone else in the far-right subculture that he'd emerged from, the perpetrator of this attack in New Zealand thinks of Donald Trump as, a positive thing, as a symbol that there is a revival of white identity, of white power. And goes on to clarify that, of course, he doesn't think that Donald Trump is the solution, and finds Donald Trump to be hopelessly moderate in his approach to this problem. But nevertheless, the fact that he's elected and the fact that he's kind of giving these kind of wink wink kind of messages to white supremacists is a sort of optimism and excitement for this group. This is why I think the way we need to look at this is that this is about something that's going on in the world that takes multiple forms that are interconnected, right? So one of the forms it's taking is the election of Donald Trump, right? Which can't be understood without understanding the racial dimension to that and the way that it mobilizes a certain idea of whiteness. And these kinds of acts of violence are another manifestation of this same sense of white identity politics. Now, the key idea here that links it all together is the idea of white victim, the idea that in one way or another, whether it's being outnumbered by immigration or outnumbered by birth rates or threatened by globalization and international competition, whatever it is, there's an idea here of white victimhood that is central. And that was central to Trump's campaign. Essentially, that's, I think, the core message of what got Trump elected is this idea that, that whites are the new victims and that they have to now assert themselves to challenge that. And that's essentially the argument of this terrorist.
You're listening to Flashpoints. Well, what can we say? I was always horrified from the moment that Trump chose Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III to be, the first senator to support him and to be the attorney general, because this is a guy who shaped a career from the earliest on trying to disempower, disembody, disenfranchise people of color, African Americans, the kind of brutal operations he carried out against various levels of the civil rights movement was legendary. Everybody was worried about David Duke, but nobody really cared a hair about Jefferson Beauregard Sessions. And then people started feeling sorry for him because he wasn't treated right by Trump. But this was a clue that Trump wasn't just a businessman playing all ends to the middle, that he really had an open mind to white supremacy, wouldn't you say?
One of many clues. I mean, I think, you only need to look through his, I mean, we can go right back, right, to his first emergence as a public figure in the 1970s. What was that in relation to? It was in relation to defending the business that him and his father ran from allegations of racial discrimination after a Justice Department investigation found that they were not allowing African-Americans to rent their homes, right? So he emerges in the 1970s defending racial discrimination. In the 1980s, you know, he calls for the death penalty for the Central Park Five, clearly not that interested in the question of whether they were actually guilty, and wanting to jump on this moment of kind of racial animus after five black, essentially teenager children were wrongfully accused of raping a white woman. And then he's a key figure in the birther movement under President Obama, which is clearly a racial project. So, you know, he's been involved in the business of kind of race construction as long as he's been involved in the business of building construction. He's, you know, that's you know, uncontroversial. Before you even get back to the longer history of his family, you know, and the involvement of his grandfather, I think it is, in the Ku Klux Klan and so forth, right? So, you know, I mean, his individual, I mean, it seems to me that his individual racism is not, you know, it's undoubtedly there. What I'm more interested in is how does he mobilize race to get elected, and how does that work, and to what extent does he need to do that explicitly or implicitly to get elected? And what does that tell us about our political climate today? I mean, you know, obviously he's not the first Republican to mobilize race to win an election. I mean, you know, it's hard to actually find one who doesn't do that. You know, going back to Nixon with his kind of silent majority law and order kind of agenda. But something what's different about Trump is that he's able to. There's two things. One is that he's able to do that in a way that is in some ways more explicit than in the past, right? So in the past, you would have had to do it in a slightly more subtle way, perhaps like 10 years ago. But now he's able to do it more explicitly, you know, particularly with regard to Muslims and particularly with regard to Mexicans and Latinos, you know, and the idea of threats to the border. And the second thing that I think is distinctive about Trump compared to previous Republicans, especially, is the way that he uses a language of class, right? So he, I mean, there's a point in the weeks just before the 2000 election where if you looked at the campaign material that the Trump campaign is putting out, the videos and so forth, I mean, the pitch they're making at that point is we are the party of the working class. And so, you know, that makes this much more potent, because what they're doing is they're taking actual insecurities that people feel, fears that people have around their jobs, around outsourcing, and racializing those to make them not about to use the language of class to actually make an argument about race and about white victimhood. And unfortunately, you know, there we have to say that, you know, they've only got the opportunity to do that. They've only got the political space to do that because the Democrats have abandoned making arguments about class and about remedying economic inequalities. I mean, at least in the 2016 campaign, they had. At least now, there's a possibility that that candidates are emerging who are willing to talk about those things in a much more assertive way. So I think, you know, we need to look at Trump and look at how his particular kind of political rhetoric works. But I think we also have to look at the broader political system and the ways in which that the capacity of the political system to address people's actual kind of economic insecurities has been sucked away.
I guess before we let you go, I mean, that's the place to ask you, do you think You alluded to a new class of candidates, maybe more sensitive to a broader vision of the world. Are you hopeful, given some of the folks who ended up in Congress? We see what happened with, for instance, with Representative Ilhan Omar. Is there a hope there for you?
I think there is. I mean, I think the way that she has been vilified for and the accusations of anti-Semitism, which I don't think have any merit, tells you something, right? What it tells you is that there's some anxiety that new candidates are getting into Congress, whether it's her or Rashida Tlaib or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who aren't following the old rules anymore and represent and aren't dependent on the old systems of patronage, because they have individual donor support that can fund their campaign. So they have an independence that most people in Congress don't have. Most people in Congress are completely dependent on corporate funders and lobbyists, which is not true of them. And so they're free to say things that other people aren't saying. They're free to, for example, talk about U.S. foreign policy. And Ilhan Omar is talking about Israel and U.S. support for Israel in actually the most moderate possible way. I mean, if you read her recent article in the Washington Post a few days ago, it's something that you would be hard pushed to say that this is some new radical voice. This is very bland kind of asking for just the most moderate concerns for human rights in Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. And yet it has provoked complete panic, I think, actually, on the part of the supporters of Israel in Washington. But I think people like her who are coming to Congress now will continue to kind of push open this kind of boundary that has been imposed on Congress for a while now, both in terms of foreign policy and in terms of what's possible in terms of, social and economic issues within the United States, healthcare, education, policing, etc. And I think that is cause for optimism. And we don't know where it's going to end. We don't know where this leads. It's the first step. We're at the beginning of this process.
You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Finally, we close today's program with an interview from Thursday's show as we take a microscopic look at the long-term criminal conspiracy formerly known as Monsanto.
Mitchell Cohen, welcome back to Flashpoints. You have been here before, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. Hi, Dennis. Hello, Berkeley and surrounding area.
All right, well, we do believe that Monsanto, now owned by our friends at Bayer, is a long-time serial murderer and of the environment. You want to give us the 60-second background? Who is Monsanto? They're in the news lately. We're going to talk about that stuff, but give us a bit of history.
Well, Monsanto makes currently the chemical called Roundup. This is an herbicide that people seem to be winning their lawsuits against Monsanto finally in courts in California.
Just won another one.
Yep, and it's very exciting. They were bought by Bayer about a year ago and for $66 billion.
Wow.
And there are now 9,000 lawsuits pending against Monsanto with possible fines for Bayer now of almost $1 trillion. So one has to wonder, why did Bayer buy Monsanto and risk $1 trillion? Yeah, it's inconceivable. What Monsanto has been doing has been poisoning the planet, basically, with the U.S. government and other governments' approval. So it's a serious situation that obviously that exists. How do we deal with pesticides? And I have a new book out. So my, and that's where a lot of the information was pulled together.
Yeah, the book I should tell people is The Fight Against Monsanto's Roundup, The Politics of Pesticides. And it's well worth checking out and getting into. You have been, I mean, I remember fighting spraying and pesticides on the East Coast in the early, mid-1980s. There were battles against the sprayers. I know, I'm sure that you jumped into this in the early 1990s. How did you get involved? And what are the sort of the poignant brought you into trying to call attention to the impact that Monsanto has had and the way in which they've been able to connive this all the way through?
Well, I got involved in the early 90s around the issue of genetic engineering. And it was a issue where Monsanto was making recombinant bovine growth hormones for milk, and that milk was being fed to our children in schools, in public schools, and we organized the whole campaign throughout the 90s against the milk in public schools and against the Roundup Ready corn and Roundup Ready soy that Monsanto was making, and that covers half the countryside in the Midwest. It covers almost all the agricultural and cotton, also agricultural acreage. And so we were wondering, how do you genetically engineer and why this product? And then we started finding out that they also developed pesticide called Roundup that goes along with Roundup Ready corn and soy. So they genetically engineered their agricultural crops to tolerate, it's one way of putting it, the spraying of this particular product, so that the product, the herbicide, kills everything else around it. And a plant is genetically engineered to resist that spraying. So we could say that it's resistant, or we could also say it's pesticide saturated. And the farmers, and they're not small farmers anymore so much, these corporate farms, huge amounts of acreage, monocropped everywhere, so that there's only one crop there that allows them to spray massively over the field. And basically it kills off not only the other organisms in the soil, but the soil itself, so that it destroys the soil. And what does it do to our bodies? How does it? And what is it doing? Well, one reason I wrote the book was not only to answer questions, because other people have addressed them. Carrie Gillum has been great on U.S. Right to Know website, and she's been following all the trials and all the information. But in the course of the trial, all this information came forth that was secret, that Monsanto knew all about this all along. They knew about the poisonous nature of it and hid those documents. And those are all coming out. And we should have known, because they also made Agent Orange, along with Dow and DuPont. So we have these giant corporations that are that have long history in creating these poisons, concealing documents from the government, their own scientists. A number of them said that you can't say this, you can't say that it's safe, you can't put it out there. And yet they did anyway. And they hid those documents. And the FDA and the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S. looked the other way and said, oh, yeah, this is okay. Of course, they didn't do any of their own testing. Right? That's how it works in this country. So they rely on the manufacturer's say-so in order to allow it to go onto the market. And the government did allow it to go onto the market without doing any testing of its own. So that was coming out in the course of the trial, which is largely why Dwayne Johnson, who has been diagnosed Hodgkin's lymphoma, and other people now are suing based on that, that claiming that Roundup has caused their cancers. And now we're also finding that Roundup, which is different from, is addition to the glyphosate that's in Roundup, which is associated with the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the other chemicals inside Roundup are also problematic, and those have, because they've been declared inert ingredients or adjuvants, they don't have to report them. The companies don't have to report them as, or the testing on them.
Let's just stay with glyphosate for a moment. My understanding that the Obama administration had finally, after many battles, we've done lots of stories on schools getting sprayed and farm workers getting covered with the stuff and profound emergencies that, you know, we're, you know, like an epidemic of brain damaged children, and it's usually farm workers and brown people that are being directly exposed. And the feds were moving and had decided, I believe the EPA under Obama was set to ban it, right? And then Obama came in and flipped that immediately.
Well, I don't know if they were ready to ban it, but it was declared a probable carcinogen, both by the IARC, the main agency within the World Health Organization associated with the United Nations, and California. And California was doing great work in investigating what's happening. And California was declaring it a probable carcinogen, too. And then, yes, then it got flipped. And not on the international level, but there was enormous pressure that was put on by Monsanto and by pesticides corporations and agribusiness, who didn't want their precious Roundup challenged in court. But now they're losing it anyway. But the idea of both genetic engineering and the pesticides, because the pesticide is matched with the genetic engineering of the plant, so the two go together. And when genetic engineering was first introduced in a big way by Clinton and Gore, they were known as the administration from Monsanto, then it became neither a Democrat or Republican issue. It became both parties were equally culpable in many ways for the extension of this pesticide over all of our agriculture. And so under Jimmy Carter, he was a genetic engineering proponent of pesticides, claiming that we needed to feed the world when we don't, as you know, Dennis, that the problem isn't that there's not enough food being produced in the world. There is. The problem is that people have been dispossessed from their lands and can't grow the food on their lands because these giant corporations have now taken over much of the land and turned it into export crops for the Europe and for the United States. So we have coffee and sugar on those lands now that used to be used as people used to use to support themselves in their communities. We're seeing that in Mexico a lot, where a lot of the corn-based Mayan communities in Mexico, the Zapatista areas in Mexico, are now being undermined by genetically engineered corn sent by the U.S., and the Mexican government has been resisting that, but it's still leached in, and it's now taking over some of those areas, and that the corn from the United States is underselling the other and putting people off their land again. So this is an ongoing, I try to address in the book not only the health issues, which a lot of people have done already, but the politics of it. So the subtitle is The Politics of Pesticides and how genetic engineering and the mass use of pesticides is being used around the world as part of a strategy to dispossess people from their lands, have that taken over by giant corporations, and moving people into export zones, into assembly zones, like in Mexico. People off their land now have to move to maquiladoras in northern Mexico because they can't afford the food anymore. They can't grow their own food. In Haiti, we had actually a document about that, which I like to think of as a smoking gun document in the 80s, in which the International Monetary Fund actually said, I have it in writing, that they're going to attempt to move one-third of the peasant farmers in Haiti off their land so that they could move them into export zones to manufacture, work with machinery to manufacture clothing for, and other goods for consumers abroad, and have that land taken over by giant corporations. And they actually said that in those words, which is unusual, but we have that. And that's their strategy. It's a strategy of capitalism. It's a strategy of imperialism. It's,
you know, in that spot right there, when you talk about Haiti, I mean, if there's ever like a lightning rod spot, because what you have on the one hand is amongst some of the poorest people in the world who are also some of the most committed to democracy in the history of this world, constantly the battle is going on as we speak, Mitchell, in terms of the people trying to fight against these corporate interests that come in and take over countries like Haiti and do what they will with the resources. And this is huge in the context of Monsanto and this kind of control of, you know, what's going to be grown and where. It's sort of an old story, getting worse all the time.
Well, that's certainly true. In fact, it's happening not only in Haiti, which both the Clintons, Hillary and Bill, and their foundation.
Thank them a great deal.
Right. Had a lot to do. In fact, Hillary Clinton traveled all around the world giving speeches pro-genetic engineering. And that was one of her main themes that she had done prior and after being Secretary of State, and probably during as well. She was giving advice on how to shape the message going out by the industries so that it didn't evoke all this opposition. But of course, people saw through it. People are not stupid. And it, not only under Clinton and Gore, but also under Bush and under the Republicans and under Reagan and even under Obama, all this was an equal opportunity destroyer.
You know, if Joe Biden took any money from Monsanto,
I have no idea.
And you know what? I'm not going to be shocked. I don't have any information in front of me, but I will not be shocked if Biden took money either from Monsanto, or who would be Monsanto's competitor?
Well, you have DuPont and Dow and Syngenta.
Where does Biden come from? Where?
Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania, no, Delaware?
Delaware. I forget where.
What
somewhere
did Delaware?
Trenton, I thought.
Corporate... secret international banking. Anyway.
Well, Delaware is DuPont, right?
So I think so.
I didn't realize that Biden was from Delaware. I thought he was from Scranton, but maybe
not. Is he Scranton? Look, I could be wrong there, too. But I know I'm not wrong that one of those or all of those corporations at one time or another bought his vote.
Well, it doesn't take much to buy their votes, because it's not only the financial donations to their campaigns, but it's also a mindset that's created where people think that this is progress, if they care about that. It's sold to us, I mean, in our own movements, where we believe that, oh, this constitutes science, it's going to make the world better for all of us. It leads to the good life. We'll have all these great scientific achievements, and as if this is science and not false science that goes into all of this. So it's... And now we have Monsanto merging with Bayer.
Yeah. But didn't Bayer first invent the aspirin with heroin in it so everybody got addicted? And that's not a fallacy, is it? Am I making this up? Anyway, I gotta go now, Mitchell. It's a pleasure to have you on. We're going to have you back. We're going to get into some depth on this book. We will feature this in a very different way. And if you're ever out here, let's do something on it. The book, by the way, The Fight Against Monsanto's Roundup, The Politics of Pesticides. Your website, best way to follow you, Mitchell.
ThePoliticsOfPesticides.com.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Mark Crispin Miller on propaganda, capitalism, empire, and the media. Could there be a connection? You betcha. I hope you'll stay tuned. I was a kid during the original Cold War. I remember reading articles back then explaining how to tell commie propaganda from God's and the United States' truth. Basically, it boiled down to this. If it's printed in the Daily Worker, it's propaganda. If it's printed in the New York Times, it's God's own truth. Just the other day, I happened to pick up that megaphone of God's own truth. The New York Times. March 13, 2019 it was. And there on page 5 was a big article on Venezuela. The headline read, quote, "Options fading, U.S. remains stymied on how to oust Venezuelan ruler." Unquote. Let me read that one again. Options fading, U.S. remains stymied on how to oust Venezuelan ruler. Now, the technical term for this little sleight of hand is begging the question. The real important issue here is not argued, but merely assumed, and then the debate is diverted to a corollary. One would think that the real issue ought to be this. Should the United States violate international law and its own claimed principles and overthrow the democratically elected government of Venezuela? But if you put the issue that way, everyone would say no, right? But the powers that be want U.S. forces to depose Venezuela's government. So, U.S. public opinion has to be changed. And so, we get public opinion molding like this alleged news story. The story pretends that the desirability of overthrow is so obvious that the only thing left to debate is the means. But even this looks like it will be a short debate. The headline strongly suggests that we will probably be forced to bomb the hell out of Caracas and then send in the Marines. And when we do, don't blame anyone on our side for such a flagrant violation of international law. All of our options short of war faded, you see. Venezuela forced us to go to war with them. So what is the Times doing? It is shaping public opinion, preparing Americans for the undemocratic and unlawful overthrow of the government of Venezuela. It is also laying the groundwork to get public opinion to approve a U.S. military invasion of Venezuela, if that is what it takes to overthrow the government and install a corporate-friendly stooge in power, namely Mr. Guaido. When some or all of this comes to pass, you will feel that the overthrow was inevitable and necessary. Golly, the United States simply didn't have any other options. In a word, this article is blatant propaganda. Propaganda is not some communist import. It's a classic, traditional tool of American capitalist government. And the U.S. government propaganda machine has been running full tilt for the past 100 years. Since the days just before World War I, when Woodrow Wilson called in Edward Bernays and George Creel to sell the war that Americans didn't want, but the Morgans and Rockefellers did. Media scholar Mark Crispin Miller talks about the connections among American propaganda, capitalism, empire, and the corporate-controlled media. These edited remarks are from a conversation he had with journalist Abby Martin in June 2016. Miller begins with the so-called father of modern public relations, Edward Bernays.
When did public opinion begin to stand out as a force to be managed by the establishment?
For all intents and purposes, I think it's probably most accurate to say that World War I marked an important turning point in the rise of what we call public opinion as a consideration for political leaders and the science of propaganda, which was used and has been used with increasing sophistication to move public opinion in certain directions, basically to make sure that we don't succumb to anything like real democracy, you know? I mean, public opinion has to be respected, but not out of any respect for the popular will. It has to be respected as a kind of mighty beast that needs to be tamed unless democracy break out and upset the apple cart. What Bernays understood brilliantly was the need to kind of shape the flow of events, to influence the media in a general way, to create an atmosphere in which large numbers of people would end up making certain choices, coming to certain conclusions without really being aware of any stimulus, you see. So he had a lot of contempt for advertising because it was too explicit. It was too blatant. It was saying, buy this. I mean, it wasn't quite as simplistic as he made it sound. He badmouthed advertising and disdained it in favor of his own method. It was to kind of create the climate in which people would do certain things to benefit his clients. My favorite example is that he represented a piano company. How to get people to buy pianos? Well, he did this by creating a craze for music rooms in homes, right? He actually contacted people in the architectural magazines and so on, and in the news media, people who wrote about lifestyle and so on. They didn't use that term then. In order to create a kind of trend for music rooms. Okay, well, you have a music room. What are you going to put in it? I mean, obviously, most middle and upper middle class people want to buy pianos, you see. So even though he never mentioned the name of the piano company, and didn't even harp on pianos per se in the propaganda, it had the general net effect of getting people to buy more pianos, so the client was happy. He had a contract to help increase sales for American Tobacco, and one of the most important things that he did to that end was to get Hollywood to incorporate cigarette smoking much more consciously and often artfully into the scenarios of movies, to get them to write cigarette smoking, lighting up, and so on, to write all that into the stories, you see. So it developed a kind of grammar of, you know, seduction, and, you know, you could express various kinds of emotions with cigarettes, depending on, you know, who lit you up or whatever. But the point I'm trying to make is that he understood that the inexplicit influence, just creating a large-scale shift in the weather, you know, to get people to do certain things. That was his great insight, you see. And now you ask, how did that come to define our world, basically? Mm-hmm. Let me answer that question by stepping back to say that I think that we live at a moment when propaganda has never been so pervasive, has never been so influential, has never been so dangerous. And I mean propaganda. I know that the word sounds terribly quaint. I say propaganda, people think of, you know, Chinese voices coming squawking over loudspeakers in Beijing, or they think of Soviet posters, right? Or Nazi propaganda. They think of Leni Riefenstahl. Actually, propaganda is not a totalitarian phenomenon primarily, although we have long since learned to think that it is. Propaganda is as American as apple pie. Propaganda at its most sophisticated was perfected, and I mean not just political propaganda, but commercial propaganda. Both kinds of propaganda were perfected jointly by the United States and Britain. In Mein Kampf, Hitler, in his famous chapter on war propaganda, talks about how deeply he admired what a brilliant job the British propagandists had done in World War I, had nothing but contempt for the German propaganda, and resolved to make sure that his own and the Nazi Party's propaganda would be brilliant in imitation of the British. So how many people does the world of propaganda employ in the United States, if you think about it? I mean, it isn't only people in public relations. It's also people in advertising agencies. It's also people in the world of so-called public diplomacy. It's also people in the world of what we call lobbying. There are countless euphemisms that we use today for propaganda, right? If you go up to a person in an ad agency or a PR specialist and say, well, how's the propaganda going, you know? They're going to be insulted. They're going to feel like you've called them a dirty name. They don't understand that they do propaganda, right? They do propaganda. And the rise of all those euphemisms for it is a direct result of the successful effort to cast propaganda as something that they do in those closed societies. The Russians do it. The Chinese do it. The Iranians do it. The Venezuelans do it. The Cubans do it. We don't do it. We educate people. We provide them with information. And that misrepresentation of propaganda has had the paradoxical effect of making it extraordinarily effective. See, because propaganda works best when you don't see it for what it is. People tend to pride themselves on not falling for propaganda. People say, you know, commercials don't work on me. You know, I can see through them. And there are a number of ad campaigns that have successfully appealed to that idea, the kind of winking, ironic advertising. It and you share a little chuckle or a little smirk over the fact that you're too smart to fall for this, right? This is kind of a postmodern move that advertising makes. Well, it's been making it in various ways really since the 30s, okay? People don't understand that even if they consciously scorn a particular ad as cheesy, or they tell themselves they don't really believe the claims, that has nothing to do with what they'll end up buying if they happen to get thirsty and they go into a store somewhere. But let's move away from the world of what they call white propaganda, which is to say propaganda that announces itself as propaganda. That's TV commercials, political speeches, stuff like that. And let's move into the world of what we call gray propaganda, which is propaganda that disguises itself as journalism or any number of dodges and disguises that propaganda puts on, right? Product placement in movies is a form of gray propaganda. And then a movie like Argo, for example, or Zero Dark Thirty, to move to more sinister examples, are movies that have a kind of geopolitical agenda that are, you know, making a case for very powerful interests within the state, movies that the CIA has actually helped the producers make.
And let's talk about what's behind the propaganda. Bernays is quoted as saying, "We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we've never heard of." Who are the invisible governors that are controlling these ideas?
It's important to note that Bernays didn't think of that as a bad thing. He thought that was a good thing because his assumption was that these august figures, these mighty figures in the worlds of business and politics and the media, were essentially benign. He actually believed that. He thought there was a kind of rationality operating up top, which, you know, as I point out in my own introduction to the new edition of Propaganda, is a groundless claim, because often people who devote themselves to propaganda end up believing it themselves. If you have a vested interest in a particular version of the truth, you're going to believe it.
It goes into just here we are today, where 90% of what Americans see, hear, and read is controlled by six corporations, six giant umbrella corporations. How does this function? You've called it a cartel, because it seems like every single outlet echoes the exact same narrative and pro-U.S. bias.
Yes, that's right. You know, for a long time, I used to think that what's happened to the media is entirely a matter of runaway deregulation, too much concentration of power, too few independent voices, too little broadcast regulation, and so on. And I think that that has a great deal to do with it. But I now realize that there's another factor that has to be considered as well, and that is the energetic involvement of the covert side of our own government in the news and entertainment business. Countless people within the media are either wittingly involved with our intelligence agencies, you know, which is something that started to be exposed in the 70s with the congressional hearings, not just the CIA, but the FBI as well.
I thought that it was a matter of real concern that planted stories intended to serve a national purpose abroad came home and were circulated here and believed here. Because this would mean that the CIA could manipulate the news in the United States by channeling it through some foreign country.
Do you have any people being paid by the CIA who are contributing to a major circulation American journal?
We do have people who submit pieces to two American journals.
Do you have any people paid by the CIA who are working for television networks?
This, I think, gets into the kind of getting into the details, Mr. Chairman, that I'd like to get into in executive session.
But then there are also a lot of people who are manipulated in traditional ways. They have sources inside the government who will give them certain tips, give them certain stories, and they end up becoming dependent on those sources for that kind of information. They break really big stories and so on, and then they, I think without even knowing it, end up carrying water for those agencies. You can hire people. You can actually pay them. You can have them under contract, which is chilling and wrong in a democracy for the government to be paying people who are supposed to be providing the public with news to basically insert state propaganda into that news. It's wrong. But it's only one way of many in which the press and often the entertainment industries end up reflecting, serving the agenda of the state and very powerful corporations. How else to explain the bizarre unanimity that we notice today of the press on certain stories that they somehow managed to get absolutely wrong over and over and over and over? I mean, I've been around for a long time studying the media in this country for decades. I've really never seen anything like this. There's an Alice in Wonderland quality to it, because we live in a country that prides itself on freedom of expression and the marketplace of ideas. And yet we see over and over and over and over again on issue after issue, there's a certain truth that is enforced with exactly the same kind of ruthlessness and impatience with any disagreement that you'll find in countries like North Korea.
It's not like it's some big conspiracy theory where there's just 100 guys in a room smoking, figuring out, here, we're going to pull this on this news agency, Fox is going to air this. The interlocking boards of directorates, the sponsorship, the direct-to-consumer advertising, especially when it comes to pharmaceutical agencies, how would you say it works? Is it just a machine functioning on its own and people are self-censoring and they just know they can't touch certain subjects?
Sometimes it happens at the moment because of a particular interest exerting pressure. A lot of times it happens in this way, you know, that a particular interest is vigilant in its own defense, is on the lookout for any kind of coverage that's going to screw with their bottom line, and then this has been going on for 100 years, okay? But you raised a really important point, the end of your question, about self-censorship. And you used the phrase conspiracy theory a moment ago, and I think it's important that we talk about that because that will help us understand exactly how this works, you know, conspiracy theory. People like me, people like you, are often, you know, dismissed, ridiculed, derided as conspiracy theorists. And this has become especially urgent and kind of vehement recently, where David Cameron of Britain actually said twice that conspiracy theorists are as dangerous as ISIS.
We must be clear. To defeat the ideology of extremism, we need to deal with all forms of extremism, not just violent extremism.
And after the Charlie Hebdo thing, François Hollande came out and said they were actually going to come up with legislation to make conspiracy theory illegal. His notion of conspiracy theory was a weird jumble of, you know, anti-Semitic fantasies and, you know, 9/11 truth and people questioning vaccines and fans of Putin, fans of Chavez. It was a kind of grab bag of forbidden topics, you know what I mean? But actually, to make it illegal, right? Conspiracy theory illegal? Well, when we hear this kind of hysterical attack on what they call conspiracy theory, we have to ask ourselves, what exactly is that? Where did that come from? What do they mean? And having been myself kind of marginalized as a conspiracy theorist right after I came out with my book on election fraud, Fooled Again, 2005, I became very interested in this question, you know, since when are we worried about something called conspiracy theory? Well, the answer to the question is that the notion of conspiracy theory, you know, that meme was pretty much non-existent in American journalism until the late 60s. If you go back and look into the archives of the New York Times, the Washington Post, and you type in conspiracy theory, you'll find very few examples. And the examples you will find are very inconsistent. The phrase is used in many different ways. Starting in 1967, there's a change. And this has everything to do with the fact that it was in the spring of 1967 that the CIA sent a memo out to all station chiefs worldwide, alerting them to the fact that there had just been published a number of books attacking the Warren Commission report. The memo defends the Warren Commission report and urges the station chiefs for the CIA all over the world to use their propaganda assets and friends in the media to discredit the work of these authors wherever possible. From that moment on, we find conspiracy theory popping up more and more often, used over and over and over and over again, and always in the same way. It's always used, or almost always used, to attack people who are raising questions about state crimes. So it's the Kennedy assassination, or the Bobby Kennedy assassination, or the King assassination. It's Iran-Contra, you know? It's election fraud.
I hate the way that the language has been hijacked to the point where you can't even talk about real open conspiracies that are documented. You can talk about a couple conspiring to kill their child. You can't talk about Wall Street conspiring or financial institutions conspiring to rig currency markets, which we know just happened. I mean, these conspiracies are off limits.
That's right.
Let's talk about going back to the media in terms of, you know, it wasn't just that they were complicit in selling the Iraq war. It's every war. It's every issue. Doubling down on U.S. militarism and basically neoliberal doctrine. Every time there's anything going on, there's just this slew of military generals on TV and also in these alt publications and online journals and such. It's just bizarre. It's like, how did that play out?
Yeah, just a few cranks out there in the world of alternative journalism will raise questions about the propriety of having all these generals appear as talking heads to bless the latest military adventure. And they're always on the boards of the big defense contractors. This is how propaganda works, right? It gets worked into the language that we all use.
Yeah.
Defense. It's not defense, you know. But, yeah, absolutely. They're all basically singing from the same sheet music, you know. And this has been increasing, intensifying, tightening up since the 70s, where there was a brief moment of a kind of uncertainty and division, a response to the Vietnam War, which divided the elites. There was a moment when, I mean, Watergate, of course, enabled people to take a skeptical view of executive power, and the CIA was under fire to some extent, you know, being investigated by Congress. There was a moment there in the middle of that decade when there was a window kind of cracked open, and that window was quickly slammed shut by the late 70s, and then the so-called Reagan Revolution kind of settled our hash for a very, very long time. But I do think, again, and not just using my own students as an example, but young people generally, the Black Lives Matter movement, Occupy, you know, these disparate rebellions suggest as inequality becomes more and more egregious and obvious and destructive, as austerity measures become more and more lethal, people are moving their way towards saying no to things that they hadn't even really thought about just a few years ago.
What is the relationship today between maintaining empire and the propaganda model?
I think that the propaganda that batters us all is so repetitious and monotone precisely because it is at the service of a kind of single dominant, use the word hegemon. I think that that's the truth. That's the case. All of our wars or all of our warlike behaviors as a nation seem to be devoted to wiping out any kind of opposition to or divergence from the neoliberal program. I mean, they've pretty much done away with a lot of the liberationist movements, you know, that were pretty frisky in the 70s and into the 80s. But we do see them going after Venezuela, for example, which is a kind of aftershock from that long struggle against the left. But the attacks on regimes that are not leftist in any real progressive sense, you know, like Saddam Hussein's Iraq or Gaddafi's Libya or Assad's Syria, are part of this kind of blind push to wipe out all resistance, to create a perfect Pax Americana.
Media scholar Mark Crispin Miller in conversation with Abby Martin on propaganda, capitalism, empire, and the mass media. Many thanks to the program The Empire Files on the Telesur Network for the audio, which I have condensed a bit. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Calm. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.
And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
We're going to be talking today about Rwanda, about some of the developments inside the country, but we're going to be talking to Robin Philpott, who was given an award for his work on bringing the truth about Rwanda, the political truth, the reality of the country at this moment, to the world. And he was one of the prize winners for the Victoire Ingabire Award. It was given in Brussels, Belgium. And in the second half, we're going to be talking to the political action chair of Local 222 of General Motors. And there is a struggle to save the plant. And if there's a popular piece of music, there's a musical called The Last Ship by Sting, and there seems to be a kind of an echo of what happened with the shipyard workers and what is faced by the General Motors workers in Oshawa. So we'll be talking to Mr. Lee about that. But I believe we're joined on the line by Robin Philpott. Are you there, Robin?
Hello, Phil.
Thank you very much for talking to us, Robin. I should tell folks you are the publisher of Baraka Books. You have published several books of your own, and you have certainly been among the first to really clarify what kind of crisis, political crisis, exists in the country of Rwanda, which for most people, listeners, it all begins in the events of 1994, and you've written about that. Now, you were in Brussels and received an award along with two other individuals. It's the award is given by the Women's International Network, and it's called the Victoire Ingabire Umuhoza Prize for Democracy and Peace. So tell us about that. What was it like? What was the kind of attendance?
First of all, I must say it was a great honor because Victoire is an inspiration. She's somebody we should all basically learn about because she went and ran in elections against Kagame, and just for that simple fact of playing the democratic game. In Rwanda, she was locked up for 8 years, and she only recently became free, and that was when they created this award. So, and it's an award a prize that's picking up steam over the years. This was the eighth edition, and the room was packed with well over 300 people. Mm-hmm. It's an event, and people from... I could say there are a lot of people from the Belgium, Holland, and France areas, but there were people from elsewhere, from Catalonia, Barcelona, and Mallorca, people from Kenya, and then a couple of us from Canada, from Quebec, and so it was. It's become. You can see that the network is growing. And it's becoming an important prize.
Yes.
So and it's a very striking event, and this was for the first time, of course, Victoire was able to address the crowd via Skype from Kigali.
Uh-huh.
She was freed, and you have to say it rather quickly because, as people point out, it's an open-air prison, Rwanda. Her movements are always being monitored,
she has to report to authorities and that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So the fact that she could speak to people, but if you'd allow me, I want to say that the whole event, there was a shadow cast on it, a kind of saddened the event, because the night previous, to this, or during the night, and this was a Saturday on the 9th, there was her chief assistant, chief assistant of Victoire in Kigali, in Rwanda, was assassinated. Mm-hmm. In, like I say, in cold blood. His name is Anselm Mutuyima.
Uh-huh.
And he was spokesperson for the United Democratic Front, Unified Democratic Front, which is Victoire Ingabire's party. He'd been sentenced to 6 years in prison and then was freed and was just working as spokesman for the party. And he was assassinated that night before, mm-hmm. which people considered it was perhaps used to destabilize this very important international event.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's rather striking. I'm glad you bring this up. I mean, it's a good time to mention that one of the problems is you have a regime that seems to carry out crimes, international crimes, actually, with impunity. And the government of Canada is very close to this leadership. People have been removed from Canada to be put into Rwandan prisons. And this is a government that kills civilians, disappears them.
Yeah. That was one of the points I tried to make in my acceptance speech was that, and it was focusing on the 25th anniversary of the shooting down of the plane, you know, within, I guess, 2 or 3 weeks now. It will be the 6th of April, which will be the 25th anniversary of the so-called unsolved assassination of two African heads of state and their entourage. Where the people who were responsible and all evidence, and I literally say all evidence from all serious investigations, says that it was the current president of Rwanda and his army party, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, that shot the plane down. Now, you can say that when you give impunity to a man like him, it just invites him to do more, mm-hmm. More of this. And this has been going on for 25 years, and people are being extradited from countries all over the world, and particularly Western countries, the United States, Canada, Belgium, France, Sweden. And we named them. I named them, and they also have a kind of a sort of a working agreement with our judicial systems here to enable that kind of extradition. So the situation is very very serious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By the way, as you say, the assassination of this man Anselm Mutuyimana. It just underlines that people there's no appreciation. Of course, it's part. You can also say it's because of the really shocking ignorance of the media. Not they make sure that people don't hear about this. This is not reported widely, they portray the president in the light of he's always called the man who saved the country, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he just made an admission in front of they had a party retreat. Party retreats, by the way, are often very embarrassing. I would never recommend anybody have one. But he decided to talk off the cuff to his supporters because it was recorded. And he said, you know, Sesenga Shanga, who had been the Minister of Interior in Rwanda in 1994 after the RPF seized power, he said he crossed the line and therefore he was killed.
Yeah.
Now, listeners of CIUT and readers of Robin Philpott should know something. It was said at the time that that was carried out by his government, and his government denied it.
Yeah.
They always said, oh, no, it's the extremist Hutus are killing each other, Sesenga Shanga being a Hutu, but he'd been a member of the RPF government.
Yeah.
Now, he told the world that, and I don't see any condemnation from Chrystia Freeland or whatever is representing the United States as Secretary of State.
Yeah. And it's public knowledge that he boasted about it. He talked about it, and this is 3 days or 2 days, in fact, the next day after this political opponent, Anselm Mutuyimana, was assassinated as well. And, you know, if we want to bring it home, you know, Seth Sendashonga was Minister of the Interior when a Canadian priest by the name of Simard, Father Claude Simard, went and complained. He was from an area just south of Kigali. And he went and complained to the minister about disappearances and killings of people under the RPF. Mm-hmm. And it was the 18th of October, 1994, that Father Simard from Montreal was assassinated while he was praying in his own room. Mm-hmm. And a Canadian by the name of Tim Iceberg, who was with the Canadian forces there under Tousignan, this was after Dallaire left, who came and found the body. And he witnessed to the effect that it was the Kagame and the RPF that assassinated this Canadian citizen. Mm-hmm. And nobody's done anything about it. And this is, you know, you could say this is very, very related to his admission or his boasting about killing Seth Sendashonga. Mm-hmm. Because Sendashonga, as Minister of the Interior, was collecting information. That's what we know about killings mm-hmm. done by the RPF during the April 1990s and 1994 and after.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably why he was assassinated.
Yeah. And by the way, and again, it's a good we engage about this, it seems to me, because he also brought in a name of a writer who also has written a book about Rwanda, much less enlightening than yours, and Mr. Prunier. And Prunier said, had commented, this was what sparked his remarks. Prunier said, Sendashonga had met with the closest advisor to President Museveni of Uganda, and that may have been what triggered his assassination by the Rwandans. And so Kagame saw that as an occasion to say, yes, that's right. That's what did it. He crossed the line. But as has been pointed out by close observers, such as yourself and others, mm-hmm. actually they had already tried to kill him in 1996 before right. he met with Mr. Museveni's.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so they're getting their lies a little bit tangled up, and they're trying to help each other out. You know, I think Prunier was trying to help Kagame by writing such a silly thing. And,
yeah,
and he failed to point notice that assassins had shot Sendashonga. By the way, it's the old thing of, you know, people forget the bystanders. A man was in the brother-in-law of Sendashonga was in the car with him and was killed on the first attempt. And Sendashonga was badly wounded.
Yeah.
But it is. I'm really. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, no. The important thing is that he fled. He left Rwanda,
mm-hmm.
And he should have been protected. He fled.
He was in Nairobi. Was, that's right.
Yeah, and he was then assassinated. And this man boasts about the assassination,
mm-hmm.
and he boasts about this assassination. But I mean. You know, we should work on having a long memory, you know.
Yes.
He's counting that people do not remember these events.
Yeah, very opportunistically playing on what he thinks is people who are controlling the narrative. So if one of them gives him a good line, he says, yeah, that's a good one. He doesn't worry himself about the details.
No.
There's many aspects to this. I'll mention one last one because I want to get to your speech too and what the audience, the gathering was like. But
the
National Basketball Association is playing footsie with Paul Kagame.
Yeah.
And powerful people arrange those. When we say, well, what does Tony Blair, what does Bill Clinton get and what do they do for him? You have to look at that kind of development. I would look at, you know, did Clinton have a role? And seeing to it that Kagame showed up at the All-Star game and or was praised by some of the coaches. I mean, this is really insidious and contemptible, actually.
Right. No, it is, absolutely. But the I think these people should be called out, Clinton and Blair, you know. I mean, The man is going around boasting about killing. The evidence is, there's so much evidence about his killing, and basically it's been the story of his life. And these other people going around pretending that none of this has ever happened. They're just like, they haven't changed their view on things. Clinton, Blair, and all the other, you could say, cheerleaders for Kagame.
We're speaking to Robin Philpott. He is publisher of Baraka Books and the author of books about Rwanda.
I did want to say that I was honored, but there were three of us. And it's very interesting that this network, and it's very well aptly called a network. Another laureate, another winner of this prize was a man named Abraham Mutai, a man from Kenya, 30-year-old social justice activist. And he's got a wide following, but he got very involved in backing Victoire and Diane Rwigara, who also made the serious crime of running for president in Rwanda and was locked up. And his story is quite something about how he got involved, and then within no time, they tried to buy him off. Rwanda tried to buy him off, like literally.
That was in his speech? Did he tell
the
story?
Yeah, he said that in his speech, $50,000. And then they wanted to bring him over to Rwanda to tell to co-opt him, probably with photo ops and stuff. He didn't go. He refused. But he's obviously got a real following. And one of the things he said, and maybe one of these days you'll be able to reach him, but he said that so many young people, and so he's 30, that means he was 5 in 1994, and he said, we've been taught in schools that Kagame put an end to the genocide and that he has been a model African leader. And so you see, that is what this man is challenging in Kenya. So you can see the network is a real network, and it's reaching out to people in different parts of the world who have an influence. And the other man, a man named Jean-Pierre Belou, is a Congolese priest working in the Brabant area of Belgium. And because as people know, Belgium was a former colonial power in both the Congo and in Rwanda and Burundi. And so there are a lot of exiled or expatriate Congolese and Rwandans and so on. But because of the war that Kagame has imposed on the Congolese, there's this very bitter feelings between the Congolese and Rwandans. And he's been, as a priest, and his general work has been to bring Congolese and Rwandans together. And so this perception that all Rwandans are doing what Kagame is doing. He's trying to defeat that perception. He's a very, very good speaker, as a lot of priests are, and uses some of his own language, when he made his speech. So it was an important event, I would say.
No, I really like that someone from Kenya, someone from Congo, those are great. It's great to hear those voices and to see them there. Because, by the way, that's a very turbulent continent at the moment, and particularly the Great Lakes region. Anybody who speaks up in the Great Lakes region is very brave,
exactly.
Because there's armies all over the place and commando types. Now, of course, there were some of the predecessors, Judy Reaver, Ann Garrison.
Phil Taylor
was there, as a matter of fact, 1 year ago. By the way, isn't Brussels a lovely city? We should always say it. But, I'll tell you what I was struck by, and I gather the same was true this year. One is the attendance is very heavy. But, you know, both Victoire and Diane Rwigara, are really, they reach out. They really do represent all Rwandans. It is, everyone knows, it knows the basic things about 1994, always learns the words Hutu, Tutsi. But in that room, when I was there, and I'm sure it's still true, is both, all ethnic groups, including Twa, are represented and are welcomed. It's not a matter of a partisan, you know, ethnic-based movement.
No, no, absolutely. It's a political movement. For democracy and peace, and they add the word freedom in it, and it that brings people together of wherever their origins, whatever their however they define themselves or are defined ethnically, it brings them together, and that's one of the strengths of the movement. There were Belgians there who lived in Central Africa. Belgians of, you know, like not of African origin. Mm-hmm. At the table I was sitting was Luc Marchal. And Luc Marchal, people should know this, he was in charge of the Kigali Battalion under the UNAMIR, which is the United Nations Forces, that was led by Roméo Dallaire. Who,
Canadian.
By the way, Roméo Dallaire, and I talked to Mr. Marchal about it, Roméo Dallaire has never gone to Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
Never. And because he's afraid that he's going to be arrested. He's not.
Well, yes.
He's not gone in there to witness in any case. He never, mm-hmm. not for the defense of Luc Marchal. Luc Marchal, because of the death of a certain number of paratroopers, 10 paratroopers in Belgium, was court-martialed there. Mm-hmm. Of course, the man is innocent, mm-hmm. and he's only recently been acquitted of, the charges have been dropped.
Mm-hmm.
But Luc Marchal's story about Rwanda is totally different from the one we've been fed mm-hmm. by our general Dallaire.
Yes.
You know. And he broke with General Dallaire in about 2004, and he said to Mr. Dallaire, "You have shaken hands with the devil,"
mm-hmm.
meaning that he's shaken hands with Kagame.
Mm-hmm.
You had a lot of other people.
That's a rewriting of the book, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And yeah. So,
you know, that's a good – we should tell our listeners, Canadians, France and Belgium both had inquiries,
yeah.
Political inquiries as to what the heck happened, because they had prominent individuals and personnel.
Yeah.
But Canada never had an inquiry.
No, Canada has not had an inquiry, and we have lost people.
The narrative has been basically handled by not speaking, simply, you know, it's kind of what you might call the suspicious silence.
Right.
A lot of publicity, a lot of books, maybe headlines, but no inquiry where someone sits down, takes an oath, and tells you what he thinks happened. Because, well, then they would end up with a different narratives, because, as you just pointed out, Colonel Marchal would tell quite a different story, or at least one that would be noticeably different. If they've been following the story only within the context of Canada.
Yeah. But another people who were there, people from Catalonia, you know, and they have brought the Spanish judicial system to investigate very seriously the death of Spanish humanitarian workers who were killed, and Catalans in particular, killed in by the RPF, and they've had a very serious investigation, and led to an indictment of 40 leaders of, including Kagame,
mm-hmm.
of the RPF regime. But Canada just goes along as if nothing happened, you know,
yes.
and they maintain this wonderful relationship with the current government.
It's very important you tell us all these things, and I congratulate you on your getting the award, and we're going to be posting that on our Facebook page, and I assume it could be Global Research published it, right?
Yeah, Global Research published it. And Black Agenda Report is published.
Oh, Black Agenda, good. Because yours is available both in French and English.
Yeah, exactly.
And so Black Agenda Report.
We'll be having, but it's in the Global Research. It's on Global Research, published early last week. Yeah. And
Well, again, congratulations. I know it was a great speech. I urge everybody to read it. In detail, the really important facts are there. Robin Philpott, thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much, Phil.
Sure thing.
Have a good day. Bye.
Bye-bye. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, the Taylor Report at CIUT.FM. We're on Facebook / the Taylor Report, and we are on SoundCloud, Taylor-Report.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
listening to Building Bridges. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Spectrum Cable strikers at 2-year mark, but they keep on keeping on. We're going to be talking about what's impeding their having a fair and decent contract. It's not only are they looking for the wages and benefits, but they're interested in taking over the cable franchise in a workers' cooperative. I'm delighted to have Troy Walcott, Local 3 IBEW shop steward, striking Spectrum technician, and also striking Spectrum technician Ray Reyes. They have enormous expertise. They've been working in this field for a long time, and it is a sheer disgrace what Spectrum is doing, and we want Spectrum the hell out of New York. But why don't we open with Troy, who we've known for a long time. We've been painfully covering this strike, and we're going to open up with a news feed
by the striking workers.
Okay, then we're going to open up with Troy.
Spectrum took over Time Warner Cable in 2016 and promised to be good to residents. They haven't been. Spectrum has raised prices on customers for less service, took away employees' retirement and medical plans, humiliated and terminated workers, and lied about providing service to underserved areas like they agreed to do. So, we went on strike. Then we had an idea. Why do we need them? The customers pay for the service, we built and maintain it. So why do we need the people who just raise prices and ruin things? We don't. The customers hate this company. We hate this company. Why not join forces and get rid of them? So, the plan is to fire Spectrum and put new owners in their place. The new owners are us. With the public and the workers as owners, we can put new management in place to focus on customer service and quality. Then we can collect the billions of dollars we have been paying them to mistreat us and use it for our city instead. Go to unplugspectrum.com. Click on Time for a New Cable option in the middle of the screen and fill out the form to show your support. From this list, we will give the first 1 million people the opportunity to be an owner of New York's cable system. Together, we can own this city. Sign up now to support and win. 1 million will become owners. Millions of others will have better service at lower cost, and the city will benefit. The only loser is Spectrum. Let's find out what this city looks like when the people own it. Share this video and join the movement. Spectrum is bad. That's it.
It's a very exciting message, but let's go back to the origin of this. And Troy, what the heck happened with Spectrum? And tell us about what's been going on with the workers.
Well, in a simple message, once Spectrum Cable moved to do the merger to take over the company, they already had in their plan where they came in saying that they were going to negotiate, but what they came in for was strictly the union bust. Their only goal was to try to get Local 3 from out of the city. So they put in place work rules and stop progression from us moving forward. Anything they could do to hinder us or try to make us feel demeaned in the workplace. Once they that wasn't working, or they wouldn't sit down and negotiate a contract that they had to negotiate what they'll be working without, then they looked to do the worst thing they could to us is to try to take away our pension and our medical benefits. And then when it got to that point, we had enough is enough, and that's when we actually went out on strike. I've worked with Time Warner Cable before Spectrum. I've been here for 20 years.
Ray, what about yourself? Your thoughts on all of this, and how long have you worked? You're also a technician.
Yes, I was in the business class arena. It was a little different, but we still dealt with the customers every day. And when I first got there, it was a great company. And then you could tell towards about a year or so before the merger, the management changed, and it got much more aggressive. And then all of a sudden, in other words, but the whole time I was there, it was more, get the job done, it'll be fine. And all of a sudden, you have to do two, you have to do three, you have to do four, stay late, stay there. And it just kept upping and upping and
upping. They'll give you boxes. They say, listen, this box isn't working. The customers are complaining. Don't worry, just keep putting them in. Listen, the customers are complaining that they're not getting the service on time. Listen, don't worry, just get there when you get there. Things began to come from working to help the customer. And they started working more towards getting the numbers to where they wanted to get it.
It seemed to me like the Time Warner was trying to set up, look how great we are for sale. In the old days, you went there and they'd say, don't worry. They cared more about how the job was done. Once Spectrum started coming, or they were getting ready for the sale, It was amazing. Just drop and go, drop and go, drop and go. You know, you used to have to stay there, check the channels with the customer. They didn't want that anymore. Did it lock? Go. The minute you saw the light go on, they didn't want you to test anything. Just go. Just kept running, running, keep running, running, running. It was terrible. It just became very stressful. It went from a job that you loved going to like, okay, what are they going to have me do today? It was crazy.
What were the main givebacks they wanted which provoked the strike?
One of the worst things they were doing was the work rules that there will be in place. They started – this is part of the attorney general's lawsuit. What they were doing was promising customers a certain amount of service, but they knew they couldn't provide it, and they were still charging customers up prices for it. So they would go in and have us put in this equipment that they know couldn't provide the internet service that the customers were asking for, and then even though it couldn't provide it, then they would penalize us for it.
You would go and you would do a dry run and test the speed. And your meter would say that it was only going to be able to do half of what they were promising. The equipment wasn't even upgraded to do it. The equipment on the and the plant on the outside were not ready for the service, yet they kept charging them that higher premium. And then when the customer would call back and say, I'm not getting my top speed, they would then punish the technician by saying, you know what, your work is not up to par, you can't advance. And you would call them up and you would tell your foreman, listen, the modem is never going to make it.
And they knew it would never make it.
The plant's never going to make it. Don't worry. Put it in. We'll deal with it.
But with our union, you had to take educational courses, fiber optics, electronics, computer classes in order to progress. So they came in and said they wanted to change the standard for progression. What we didn't know is the standard that they changed it to shortly after, they got people from their management staff appointed to the board of directors that administers the testing and administers the curriculum. So we saw our numbers begin to dramatically drop as far as progression. So everything they had was basically towards moving us to a position where they wanted us to strike, and that was because their goal was to try to get the union out, not try to work with us.
And how many workers are we talking about, and who are the workers?
1,800 men and women that deal with anything and everything that had to do with the technical aspect of providing cable to New York City.
It was the plant. It was the installations. It was the repairs. It was the call center. It was anytime you dealt with someone that had to deal with your cable, other than paying your bill, you dealt with a union person who was a lot of times had a lot of experience and had a lot of training and was trying to get the job done the best they could.
But pity the poor downtrodden boss, right? Spectrum comes in, they get this company from Time Warner, and they're just hurting. They're just building up again. What is a poor boss to do? What? Pensions, benefits, education plans, not taking the time out on the hide of the consumer and the technician. Of course, I'm being tongue-in-cheek here, but tell us about who the heck Spectrum is as a company. Are they this poor little, pity the downtrodden that comes in, and who are they?
They are actually the second largest cable provider in the country.
Spectrum Cable makes, $41 billion last year, and their CEO is on the highest paid, makes $100 million a year. Tom Rutledge. Believe me, they're not hurting for money at all.
In a mansion in Connecticut.
This was never about money for us. We weren't asking for anything. All we were trying to do was just maintain the life that we already had built 40 years. We built this city. 40 years it took us to build and put the city together. And in 2 years, these companies came in. They're not even from here. They're not from New York. But they're coming and trying to tear it apart. Everything that has to do with New York. And it's not just about us. It's about the customers. It's about the elected officials. Every government agency that they lied to. Every promise that they made and they continue to break. They don't care anything about New York City besides taking what profit they can, taking from the city and running.
And I went to a major demonstration where we marched with you folks from Brooklyn over to Foley Square.
It was a great event.
It was a great. And then the politicians were falling all over each other to say this was a union town. Cuomo, I almost marched arm in arm. Not completely. Mayor de Blasio. So where are they? They said they supported the workers. They still have the possibility, and they did then, to say, you ain't getting the renewal of the franchise, Spectrum, unless you keep the living standard, keep the benefits of these Spectrum workers. So what's happened since then?
Maybe they're still at the rally stand. And then listen, this is a true fact, because in the last two elections, I speak to a couple of family and friends, because right now I'm much more politically involved since this has happened. And I just asked them offhand, like, who are you voting for? And they'll tell me, well, you know, I'm voting for this person. I saw them with you up on stage at the rallies. I said, yeah, you know what? That's the last time I saw them, too.
They're there for the photo op, and then you don't hear from them I mean, there have been a couple of local assemblymen who have been good because we live in their district. But by and large, it's really been a lot of lip service. I know and I understand. I appreciate that the franchise was written very poorly and it leans in the company's way. But there are things that they can do and pressures they can put and levers they can pull where they can let it be known that if you don't do the right thing, we want you gone.
And if not, at least don't come in and say that. Continue to promote that it's a union town. We've been out here now for 2 years. When we sit at home and we've been out for 2 years and hear these people get out and say it's a union town and it has to be union, you better be union. And we know that behind the scenes they say support for us but don't actually do anything. It tears us apart to hear these people say over and keep that out of your mouth. Don't say that this is a union town and you support unions 100% if you're not willing to do what it takes to come out and fight for us. Fighting for us is doing more than just coming on the stage and saying it one day and we never see you again. Fighting for us is actually doing stuff to take an action and stay involved. There are some politicians who continue to support us and say things about us and keep our name out there, and we definitely appreciate that. If I could say some of them names, I would. And there's some of them that the last time that we saw them was only on that stage when you saw them.
What is it meant? For you, where does the spirit and the energy come from? 2 years and counting, Ray Reyes and Troy Walcott. What does it mean? How important is it for you to keep persevering and to demand that you get your just dessert from the work that you do?
I mean, there's many reasons, but for me, the main reason I do it is there are guys who have been my foreman, my coworkers, and the guys who put 20, 25, 30 years. But, you know, due to circumstance, they're 3 or 4 years too young to retire. I stay out there so that these guys can go back with dignity and retire 100% vested. I think it's disgusting that a company would tell these guys, you're 55 and we don't want you anymore and we're going to kick you to the curb. Thank you for building it. Thank you for making us all this money. But now, goodbye. I do it for those guys. I want those guys to be able to go back and say, maybe give a profane gesture to the company and retire with some dignity.
Well, me is for, like, I get a call like from one of my guys the other day. This is somebody that I've watched take the progression in the company, fight to get books. Now, the person has a son already that's disabled. Everything in his life was trying to make sure he has as much time possible to make sure he spends with this kid. So he did everything he could to bust his butt to get to the point in the company where he can build up to actually provide for his family and live a life where he could spend as much time possible with his kids. He called me now. He's working 2 jobs, one as a custodian and another one working at a gym. From the gym now, he's doing cleaning. And somebody else there who had a $1 million job is working right next to him doing the same thing because hard times fall on everybody. And the people at the gym ask him, you don't belong here. You don't seem like you belong at this place. How did you end up here? And no matter what, whether he's doing a custodian, he said he's clean. If you're doing cleaning toilets as a custodian and he's doing it and you ask him why, it's because he feels that this fight is more important to keep going because his kid's future and everything that he's fighting for and his character and his value is more important than going back to a company that he knows is trying to destroy him. When I get calls like that from people that are fighting that hard, people are putting that much effort in and staying out only on character, there's no way that I could turn back and not go and do everything I could to help them.
So there's one other even scummier piece. They're trying to decertify, and I'm not sure everybody knows what decertify
means. Management's doing it also.
Management is trying to actually decertify, meaning that you no longer, that your local would no longer be the bargaining agent. You would no longer have a union. So tell us about that struggle that these scurrilous, wealthy plutocrats, these bosses, are engaging.
And the best part is they tell the workers, we can better represent your interests than the union can. and you look at them and you're like, anyone who buys that, I have a bridge for you.
And they are trying to do that, right?
Well, no. According to them, it's not them. It's allegedly, it's not them. It's all coming from the workers.
Send out an internal email to have all the employees saying that you should decertify this union.
Correct. So that's their in and around way of doing it. What actually happened was there was somebody hired at the company, Bruce Carberry, as a supervisor. Right before the time where it became possible for certification to take place, this person that was a supervisor,
Bruce Carberry,
amazingly dropped down to the level of a technician.
Beautiful chorus.
Bruce Carberry.
Put you guys on the news.
Once he dropped down to a technician, it made him eligible to be able to put together the certification petition.
They lowered him to a Tech 3, and when we left, the Tech 3 made $13.50 an hour. So at most, even if you did a ton of overtime, maybe you'd hit 40,000. This guy made 95,000.
For some reason, even though he's not, the company's not behind it, he seems to make $60,000 more than his position is entitled for.
And he doesn't even do the work.
He was the person that brought forth the decertification petition, and we challenged that at the NLRB. And some of the stuff that goes on as far as the laws that's in place, I can't understand, because even a blind man could see. If you have a person who miraculously moved from a supervisor to a technician position at a perfect time and to try to decertify and then also make $60,000 more a year than the position is worth, how can you not see that that's somebody intentionally looking to desert?
Bruce Carberry. Yeah,
the rotten NLRB didn't throw this thing out, though, the National Labor Relations Board. So something's going on there.
Correct. So that's why I always wonder, if that's the case, who's on our side? Who's the one that's helping for us? If someone could see this, anybody could look for coming out from the outside looking in, and no one's going to help to protect us, who's on our side?
The people listening here are going to be on your side. So now let's move to, we understand how wealthy, how scummy, how incompetent, how do-nothing, well, they're vampires, right? They suck the blood out of the workers and they make the profits for themselves. Classic. Where do we go from here and what do we want support for? Because I know, now I said, oh, we want de Blasio, right? And we want Cuomo to say, hell no, you don't get the franchise. You folks are saying, and you're talking now about a workers' cooperative to get a franchise, which is really exciting. So tell us more about that.
They don't deserve the franchise. They don't deserve to negotiate for it. They don't deserve to have it. They don't deserve to have it this moment.
Excuse me one sec. The franchise is that the city gives them permission to cable our streets, to use the public land and the state.
Correct. It gives them the permission to do business.
And nothing.
Without that, they can't make a single dollar.
So the city has a lot of control. So
you would think.
How do we get to that point of that workers' co-op?
The Public Service Commission has already seen this company doing bad. They've broke so many promises. It came to the point where it's unprecedented. The Public Service Commission told them to leave the city. But because there's nothing in place to substitute them, I believe the politicians are more fearful of a backlash from any type of interruption. So they will placate to them and let them have extension over extension over extension to try to stay in the city. But what are they telling their people on the inside? They told them, don't worry, the Public Service Commission 100% will never kick us out of this city. They're laughing at us to their people behind the scenes. And then we have a franchise agreement coming up that's up for renewal. They had violation after violation after violation of that franchise agreement. Those don't go away. So now when it comes time for the franchise agreement, are the people that have to make that decision going to do the same thing and say that, you know what, because we don't want to make a disruption, that we're not going to do anything? If we don't have the guts to do something to move forward to make a positive change, this city needs money for MTA and needs money to keep itself running. Why wouldn't we take on a responsibility like this? Since the city didn't want to do it, the workers are willing to do it. Where we put our 40 years of knowledge to the test, start our own company with the customers and the citizens, we can own this cable company and move this bad actor out of here. They already done enough for this city that they don't belong here. Nobody says they want him here. So why wouldn't you take the easiest answer and a step forward to try to get them out?
We built the system. We can maintain the system. We can expand the system. And Troy, don't forget, they've been fined. Didn't they just settle a lawsuit for $174 million?
But this is the thing. That's nothing to them. What he's talking about is the Attorney General lawsuit. So the Attorney General, and they posted it all over the paper. Spectrum has to pay $174 million settlement, the biggest that settlement unprecedented. That's because they were lying to the customers and charging them for services they knew they couldn't provide. Mm-hmm. Now, if you steal something, if it's over $3,000, it's grand larceny, you'll go to jail. These people made $1 billion from stealing from the customers of New York City and had to pay back $174 million. If I'm a company and I can do that, why would I ever stop doing it? I'd do it over and over again. If it was anybody else, if it was a regular person, you stole that much from somebody, you'd be in jail. What they got to do, they steal $1,000 from you and give you back $5 and keep doing business as normal. That's what's happening in this city, and none of these elected officials are doing anything about it to try to stop it.
They also owe the city $6 million in fees that they have collected and still have not handed over. They say it's $6 million right now, and they haven't even invested. They're doing a further investigation. For all you know, it could double or triple.
Because it's nothing to them.
And you know what you all got to do? You all need to get Ray Reyes. You need to get Troy Walcott and their other comrades out there to speak to your community group. because what we were saying before we went on air, not enough people in the public know about this outrage. This outrage, the outrage to the consumer, the outrage first and foremost to the workers, and you've got to have them come out. And if you want to, you can just give me a holler, and I'll put you in touch with them and get them to come out and talk to you to build community support. And I can be reached at Rosenberg, B-E-R-G, at legal-aid.org. But you can get in touch with me, and I'm going to put you in touch with them. Now, what else can
we
do?
I've also got a dynamite website that people can look at.
Yeah, yeah.
And sign up on that, right?
What's the website?
The website is unplugspectrum.com. That's unplugspectrum.com. You can go on there. What we're going to try to do, especially now,
people can get in touch with you that way. It is a great website.
Correct.
In any event.
Correct. We're going to try to now do a public outreach. We'll be going to the city streets, and we're going to people. If they don't know about us now, we're going to go to them and make sure they know about what's going on and the public option that's available so people can get involved and participate in on this thing.
What else do we need to do to make sure that, well, it's a three-pronged struggle, really, it looks like. One is, I still want the company to capitulate, to give you what your just desserts are. So how do we do that? And how do we, take over the darn company and the franchise work for the workers? How exciting. I think about the Green Bay Packers, you know,
right,
and
right,
so
right,
on.
Right.
Of very, course we should have workers' co-ops that do this.
A very famous one right there. Green Bay Packers are very famous.
Yeah, do you know what I'm talking about with the Green Bay Packers?
Yeah, and the only ones who are unnecessary is management.
Right.
Right. We, New York, our workers should own these franchises. They're the ones who do the work. They're the ones with the expertise. And it's your blood, sweat, and tears.
Right.
Other locales have done this, and they've run the fiber, and they've maintained it with city workers.
Chattanooga, Tennessee.
And it's been very, very profitable, very, very successful.
Yeah, Jackson, Mississippi.
One of them were actually able to tell Verizon wanted to come in and say, we'll do Fios. And they said, no, thank you. We don't need you. And so, everyone's bill was lower. And they said they appreciated the service more.
How do we do this?
The first stage right now is just getting people to support the idea. It's never ever that you'll be able to own a cable company and be part of it and just by signing your name on a piece of paper. We have 2.5 million. I know the AFL-CIO, I listened to the podcast the other day that's recently out. They were talking about 2.5 million union members. It's impossible for 2.5 million not to just go on and support and say, hey, you know what? Even if it's because they were out 2 years or just because I think this is a good idea to go on and support, go on unplugspectrum.com, sign the petition and support that idea. Once it's there, we go on to the next step to actually forming the company to just take over and move this company out completely. Once we own that and we have the political power to now come together with real solidarity, we can own everything. Because as far as union members, we had a lack of education and moving forward to take the next level that we have to as unions moving forward. We have to start doing that, and we have to start doing it. And the economic engine of owning a cable company could be the biggest thing to help that go forward.
I mean, me personally, I think this is a very viable plan. When guys first went on strike, they were like, I don't think I could do a week. And then we did a week. It became a month, 3 months, 6 months, a year. Now we're almost out 2 years. And there's a very good chunk of us who are still out, who won't cross the line based on principle and based on the fact that we will not capitulate to their vampire tactics, for lack of a better word.
Maybe you can also
get
some
decent. I think it's a real good word.
It really is.
Get some decent labor coverage and working class coverage on the cable station. Right now, they blocked it all out.
Well, of course, you know, the minute we went, the first 30 days we were on strike, it was fair. We were getting some coverage. It was kind of, I wouldn't say balanced, but it was there. Then all of a sudden they went into full PR mode and they quadrupled their advertising budget, and that's how they bought off the stations.
It's a payoff.
And in other words, if I'm your biggest advertiser, you're not going to step on my toes.
Well, I also want to tell consumers, I'll be damned. I will not get Spectrum. No how.
Thank you very much.
No time.
Thank
no
you.
Place. And I also tell the company why I won't do it. Hell no.
And as they try to expand that mobile service that they're doing, that's an option that everybody has. No one should be picking up their mobile service in this city. Their name should be complete trash when it comes to New York City, if not every place else. Because what they're doing to this in this city alone, they're not even from New York. Since when do people come in and run New York?
They were from Missouri originally.
From you folks, like, okay, I'm in the UAW. I want a resolution that I can take to my union to pass on behalf of you folks. You tell us what you want to do, because we've got to get more visual on board labor support. So I want to see our different locals saying this is what we endorse. Write up, you know,
petition.
What we're doing right now, that's what we're trying to reach out to the rank and file. I'm tired of speaking to the brass for unions, because I speak to union members directly and sometimes they don't hear. I want to reach out to the men and women directly. If there's 60,000 people in your union, I should see 60,000 signatures
local
supporting
this. Local 2325, UAW, Local 1199, those are the paralegal support staff, et cetera, that work at the Legal Aid Society.
Very good, very good.
The attorneys. We're going to take up a resolution. That's what I'm looking at. It's a resolution in support of what you want to do. So, Troy,
much appreciated.
I'm going to be on board, and let's get that to our unions to support. Let's get it to our after unions, WBAI's people who are on staff here are in AFTRA. No way we shouldn't support it, and damn well part of that should be, how dare you, de Blasio, ever go on New York One? You said you wouldn't. You said you wouldn't. Damn it, you want to run for president? Get with it, brother. This is a union town. Support our striking Spectrum workers, and support. We don't want Spectrum here anymore. We want a workers' co-op running the cable franchise.
Least mention us.
Yes, at least mention us.
So, this is not the last. I think we should, in another couple of weeks, pick up on this.
We'd love to come here. We'd love to come back.
And can you take us out with a chant? I mean, since you had
We tried that last time. It was horrible.
Quite honestly, it was horrible.
One thing I would like to say.
It's been a while since I've been on the
one last thing I would like to say is, as you listen to this, and if you go on the field that you feel what we're saying is resonates with you, if you're not willing to go on and sign that petition, you don't really care. You have to take action. You can't step back and be a spectator.
Absolutely. And we've been speaking to Troy Walcott, Local 3 IBEW shop steward, striking Spectrum technician. Ray Reyes, striking Spectrum technician. And what does your shirt say? That's going to be our slogan.
Elected officials, don't renew Spectrum's union busting.
Now let's do this in unison, together.
Elected officials,
don't renew Spectrum's union busting.
Give me that website address again.
The website is unplugspectrum.com. That is unplugspectrum.com.
Sign the petition.
Sign the petition, and we'll work on it. Some resolutions.
Thank
we're going to get it to our
Thank
unions,
you very much.
Right? We're going to get AFTRA members. We're going to get UAW. We got more to go. Love you, brothers, and stay strong. And
this is
a union town. And listen, listeners, Spectrum, boycott it. Don't do it. And let the company know why. And let your politicians know that we want a worker franchise for the cable. And it is our 2 years and counting strong Spectrum workers. Thank you both.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
The film centers around Jennifer Laude, who
was a trans woman in the Philippines that unfortunately was killed by a U.S. Marine. And the story really takes place when it's discovered that local authorities cannot detain the Marine due to these visiting forces agreements between the two countries.
There's a lack of justice in many trans people's lives. If members of our community are killed every day, then there is no justice in the world.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lisha Chappelle. Botswana's High Court considers queer sex ban challenge, far-right Polish party launches pre-election homophobic ploy, and slain Filipino trans woman's story survives in Call Her Ganda. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 16, 2019. Botswana's High Court held a one-day hearing on March 14th in a case challenging the criminalization of consensual adult gay or lesbian sex. Courts in the Southern African country decided a few years ago that the law applies to women as well as men. Attorneys pushing for repeal argued that Botswana society has changed markedly since the anti-gay sex laws were established, a gift of the British colonizers, and that they're outdated and should be overturned. Lawyers for the government said that the law should reflect on the values of society and claimed that while attitudes may have changed in other parts of the world, there haven't been any significant changes in societal attitudes in Botswana toward gay people to warrant repeal. Same-gender love was, in fact, widely accepted among the native Tswana people before British colonizers brought their homophobia with them, including a penal code that punishes carnal knowledge of any person against the order of nature with up to 7 years in prison. Another statute, Indecent Practices Between Persons, carries a sentence of up to 2 years. Equality activists attended the hearing in large numbers, some holding placards that read, "Stigma Must Fall" and "My Bedroom, My Privacy." High Court Judge Abednego Tafa told the packed courtroom in the nation's capital, Habaroni, that a decision would be issued on June 11th. Kenya's High Court is scheduled to announce its ruling on that country's British colonial-era laws outlawing same-gender sex in May. Angola reportedly became the first country in Africa earlier this year to overturn its anti-queer sex laws.
Germany's Justice Ministry issued a directive this week authorizing financial compensation to people who were being investigated or taken into custody but not convicted under the country's Nazi-era laws against consensual adult gay sex. Even though the notorious paragraph 175 was instituted under Hitler to snuff out what had been a boldly emerging gay rights movement, the governments of post-World War II Germany's each kept paragraph 175 on the books until East Germany removed it in 1968 and West Germany followed suit a year later. Unified German lawmakers ordered the records of thousands of convictions under that law to be expunged in 2017 and offered payments equivalent to about $3,500 for each conviction, plus half that amount for every year of prison time that a person started to serve. This week's directive authorizes payment to those investigated and or detained, though never convicted, of about $600 for each investigation that was opened, plus about $1,800 for each year a person was held in pretrial custody. An estimated 70,000 people were convicted of consensual same-gender sex under paragraph 175, but the Justice Ministry announcement this week said that many more who were prosecuted but ultimately not convicted also deserved compensation. But it added a disclaimer that the payments are not to be understood as damages, but as part of a symbolic recognition of impairments suffered.
Poland's ruling far-right Law and Justice Party has decided to play the homophobia card ahead of upcoming European Union elections in May and national elections later this year in the heavily Roman Catholic country. Their favorite boogie people in the 2015 elections were foreigners. At its annual convention, party leader Jarosław Kaczyński warned that voters who fail to support law and justice this year would allow nefarious forces to influence the upbringing of their children. "Our opponents attack our social policy," he said, "and even worse, attack families. We will defend the Polish family." He ridiculed Warsaw's mayor for humanely liberalizing policies affecting LGBTQ people earlier this year, calling Rafael Trzaskowski's 12-point declaration unbelievable. He talks nonsense about alleged plans to corrupt children, the mayor shot back in a Facebook post. Trzaskowski described his initiatives as being about tolerance, to protect our fellow citizens from hate speech, intimidation, and lynching. Another opposition party member, Monica Rosa, said the entrenched right-wing government is building a campaign of hatred toward LGBT people. Let them really protect children, she added, by fighting against pedophilia in the church.
Queer organizations around the world joined the global chorus of outrage and sadness over the massacre of some 50 Muslims during Quiet Friday prayers in two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. An Australian-born white nationalist who posted a voluminous, hate-filled manifesto and live-streamed the massacre called his targets invaders. U.S. President Donald Trump expressed America's condolences, but went on to veto the congressional resolution opposing his so-called national emergency by warning of criminal invaders at the country's southern border. The queer U.S. advocacy group Human Rights Campaign called hate violence against Muslims a global epidemic and said that we mourn for the victims and their families. Leading UK advocacy group Stonewall said that it's more important than ever to stand together in solidarity. A number of U.S. politicians already competing for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination also expressed their sadness and outrage. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, the only openly queer person in the race, so far at least, called the massacre an attack on us all. May every New Zealander and every Muslim hurting today feel lifted up in love and solidarity. And yet again, the obvious bears repeating, white nationalism kills.
A memo published on March 12th by the U.S. Defense Department has put the wheels in motion to implement Donald Trump's ban on military service by qualified transgender people. The new order bans trans-identified enlistees if they've already transitioned, and new trans recruits must be willing to serve in their birth gender and promise not to transition. Currently serving trans troops who aren't willing to serve in their birth gender will be discharged within a month. The directive gives all branches of the armed forces until April 12th to have the policy in place. The U.S. Supreme Court lifted the injunctions issued by lower federal courts stopping the ban, though some lawyers claim that a D.C. court injunction remains in place pending a final appeal. According to The Advocate, the trans ban will require the discharge of an estimated 13,700 service members out of the estimated 15,000 trans troops now serving. That would be the largest single workplace layoff of transgender people in history, despite congressional testimony from virtually every U.S. service chief that they've seen no discipline, morale, or unit readiness problems as a result of transgender troops serving openly in the military. Several LGBTQ rights groups assailed the move to withdraw the welcome mat laid out by the Obama administration in 2016 to honorably serving openly transgender troops. Statements by OutServe SLDN and the American Military Partner Association called this horrific policy even more cruel than Don't Ask, Don't Tell, to which many have compared the Trump trans ban, because the Pentagon explicitly told these service members in 2016 that it was finally safe to come out, and now they're being targeted for discrimination. The policy requiring trans people to serve in their birth gender or get out betrays our service members, the statement adds, and is based on nothing more than blatant bigotry.
And finally, Ireland's proudly out Prime Minister Leo Varadkar brought his boyfriend with him, Dr. Matt Barrett, to what he called a lovely breakfast at the home of notoriously anti-queer Mike Pence during pre-St. Patrick's Day ceremonies this week at the official vice presidential residence in Washington. Varadkar also met with President Trump, Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and other political leaders during his visit. Pence's wife, Karen, who would normally have co-hosted the vice presidential breakfast, was conveniently out of town, so Pence's sister filled in. The vice president's wife probably feels quite at home in the queer, hostile United Arab Emirates, where she is on an official visit leading the U.S. delegation to the Special Olympics World Games. Mother, as hubby Mike calls her, has been criticized for teaching at a private religious school in the D.C. area that rejects queer students, queer parents, or any LGBTQ supportive student or school employee. Most such events are open to the press, as was last year's Pence breakfast with then-Irish PM Enda Kenny. But even the leading newspaper in his home state, the Indianapolis Star, criticized the vice president for meeting with Indian Irishman Varadkar behind closed doors. We don't know what Pence and the prime minister discussed during their get-together, though Varadkar vowed ahead of time to raise LGBTQ rights issues with U.S. officials during his D.C. visit. He was not shy about expressing his personal gay pride in brief remarks after a vice presidential introduction before members of the press were forced to get their breakfast elsewhere.
I stand here, leader of my country, flawed and human, but judged by my political actions and not by my sexual orientation, my skin tone, gender, or religious beliefs. And I don't believe that my country is the only one in the world where this story is possible. It's found in every country where freedom and liberty are cherished. We are, after all God's children.
That's NewsWrap, Global Queer News with Attitude for the week ending March 16th, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the ever-updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Michael Lebeau.
Hello, this is the actor Michael Emerson, Ben on Lost. It's not easy being one of the others. So if time travel or moving the island isn't an option and you're feeling sort of lost, try listening to Greg and Lucia on This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
When a U.S. Marine killed a trans woman alleged sex worker in Manila, the case may have gone without much notice. But Jennifer Laudet's story is being kept alive thanks to her bereaved mother, a determined trans reporter, a courageous attorney, and an award-winning documentarian. The documentary opens in the Philippines and the UK this month, and it's slated to air on U.S. public television in July. This Way Out's Christopher Gall sat down with the director to discuss his film and its worldwide impact.
Director P.J. Raval has been named one of Out Magazine's Out 100, was the keynote speaker at South by Southwest in his home base of Austin, Texas, earlier this month. His latest film, Call Her Ganda, about the brutal murder of a trans woman in the Philippines by a U.S. Marine, premiered last year and has been screening at festivals and in theaters around the world. It's currently nominated for a GLAAD Media Award. P.J. Raval joins us now at our Los Angeles studio. PJ, thank you for being with us on This Way Out, and congratulations on the nomination.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Briefly, walk us through the story of Call Her Ganda.
The film centers around Jennifer Laudet, who was a trans woman in the Philippines that unfortunately was killed by a U.S. Marine. And the story really takes place when it's discovered that local authorities cannot detain the Marine due to these visiting forces agreements between the two countries.
When did you first hear about Jennifer Laudet's story? How did you find yourself making the film?
Yeah, so Jennifer was killed October 11th of 2014, and I happened to be in the Philippines shortly after. I was fortunate enough to be invited to go to Manila to screen some of my previous documentaries, and when I got there, I discovered the story of Jennifer, and I happened to meet attorney Virginia Suarez, which is how I got very interested in the story.
You cannot help this case. You cannot help the loudest if you just know things about the killing, if you just know things about the murder, because it's not a simple case of murder.
The police station. Then I will have to, you know, check it one by one against.
The relationship between the U.S. and the Philippines is really a relationship between a colonizer and a colony or a neo-colony.
One of the reasons I also wanted to make this film specifically is, for whatever reasons, I think as a culture, the Philippines has really been overlooked in the United States. As someone who grew up in, you know, Central California, there was a lot of confusion on Filipino. People thought I was either Latino or I was Chinese, you know? There was kind of nothing in between. So part of me wanting to make this film was also just to expose people to the Philippines and kind of the true history, or one of the, you know, some of the history that's been overlooked and perhaps even intentionally buried, you know?
Full disclosure, I worked on this film. I played a small part in its production. Late in post-production, I designed some motion graphics for the film.
I wouldn't say it was a small part. Okay. I'd say it's a pretty significant part.
Okay. Doing that gave me a little bit of insight into the film as it took shape. One thing that I noticed, it was my observation, was in the early cuts of the film, as I saw them, seemed to focus a lot on the narrative, on the story, and how the events unfolded. The later edits, after you spent a lot more time in the editing room, integrated more of the stories of the three women, Meredith, Jennifer's mother, and Virgie Suarez, the attorney. Tell us a little bit more about how that evolved in your process.
You know, early on, when I started making this film, I kind of knew there were certain aspects I wanted to follow about this story. So the first was definitely Nanai, Jennifer's mother. She was really one of the inspirations of making the film. When I met attorney Virginia Suarez, she actually showed a clip of Nanai that she had filmed on her cell phone, and I was really moved by it. And it was basically Nanai saying, you know, how could someone do this to my child? I'm not going to rest until, you know, I see some kind of accountability. And I was so moved by that, just because Nanai just has such an incredible presence. Like, she's incredibly, she just has a lot of heart, very passionate. And also very much in a very difficult position where she has to grieve very publicly, and recognize just kind of what she's kind of up against, that no one's really paying attention to this and no one really cares about, you know, the loss of her child. So I was really moved by Nanai, and I kind of knew she was going to be the heart of the film.
She was working at a beauty salon. At the salon, she would wash and clean to get free food. Every week, she would send me all her money. And she promised, "Mom, when I come home, they will not make fun of me and call me a queer. I will have accomplished something. My life has value," she said.
And having first met Virgie, I already knew that I wanted to follow Virgie, because Virgie is, I mean, she embodies action to me. Like, she is someone who is constantly doing, thinking, trying to make some kind of change, not only as a lawyer, but also as an activist, also as a mother, also as a woman. So I was incredibly inspired by her, and I started thinking of her as kind of like the body. So, right, if Nanai is the heart, then Virgie is kind of the body and the flesh and kind of, you know, putting things into motion. And then the last person I met was Meredith. And Meredith, as the investigative reporter, but also someone who is trans herself, I kind of thought of her as kind of like the intellect in the head, because she was someone who was really questioning things and really thinking about things from really large, from a much larger perspective than most people had. Most people had just focused on the crime itself, but Meredith was able to contextualize it and really understand the significance of it. So I kind of thought of her as the head, right? The brain. And so I started thinking of the three of them as this body. And that kind of came about while I was editing. And I started understanding how the three of them in their own experiences inform each other. Because all of them are working towards the same thing, just in very different ways.
The club was a frequent hangout for sex workers known as Pocahontas, a riff on pokpok, a Tagalog term for slut, which also alludes to the former colonizers who often patronized them. The most dogged of these women, those who quickly latch on to the arms of the men pouring off the ships, are usually transgender, but the foreign soldiers rarely learn that.
That was journalist Meredith Talusan in the film Call Her Ganda.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens, Noah in the Noah's Ark movie and TV series, and you've discovered This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities. and those who love them.
We're talking with director P.J. Raval about his film, Call Her Ganda. I'm Christopher Gall. As you mentioned just now, the film is both, I think, intensely personal and of its time and place, but it's also sweeping in the questions that it brings up. It's the story of the family's grief and their sense of loss, Jennifer's story. It paints a picture of the daily trans life in the Philippines. There's a story of homecoming a bit in there with Meredith. But it also tackles the themes of international diplomatic relations, the echoes of colonialism, sex work, and these larger themes. How did you, as a filmmaker, balance the personal and the political, or the small and the large issues as you were putting together the film?
Yeah, it's a lot, right? I think the way you balance it is you treat it all equally, because it is all equal. And in a sense, like, that truly is embracing it from all the perspectives that it really needs to be embraced by. I think early on, I felt pressured from other people to make a true crime drama, for instance. And I said, well, if you do make some kind of true crime, like, you know, you might be overlooking other things here that are really important. And for me, the film really isn't about the crime itself. For me, it's about the environment of how a crime like this comes to be, and also what is the accountability for it, and what is the prevention of stopping something like this. So if we are looking at something that's kind of about, something that's more about structural inequality, for instance, you have to look at the bigger picture, and you have to understand not only the bigger picture, but how that affects people in their daily lives. So you can't really look at one without looking at the other. And I do think we're living in a time now where people are finally understanding how things intersect, right? And even using the term intersectionality. So just the idea of, like, how race affects class, and how that affects, how that's complicated by gender and complicated by nationality, all these things. So it's not so simple to just look at one thing. You kind of have to look at all of them simultaneously, because they all affect each other. You know, one of the things that I've had said to me about the film is, and from members of the trans community, that they appreciate that in the film itself, you see different representations of trans women, right? Like, some can be a reporter, some can be an activist, and some can be in Olongapo and working in sex work. All the different kind of roles that these women take, but also that they have different ideas. They live different lives, and sometimes, their experiences are very different.
There's a theory in physics that observing a phenomenon changes that phenomenon.
Ooh, wow.
How do you think making this documentary has changed the trajectory of Jennifer Loudy's story?
Wow. That's a great question, and that's a really great theory. I think in general, no one would have known who Jennifer Loudy is if it weren't for people like Meredith Tolusan reporting and Virgie Suarez standing in front of the courthouse, making statements about why it's important for us to pay attention to this, and for Nanai to be going on national television talking about how much she loved her daughter. Like, these are things that, change who we think Jennifer Loudy is. And I would like to think that this film also does that, that it captures their stories and in the process of captures Jennifer's stories. And in an interesting way, like with all the films that I've made, secretly, they're also documents of my own life because I was there, to make it. So for me, when I watch the film, I also just think about how much it's also changed me in terms of, I feel much more connected to the Philippines. I feel much more just kind of proud of my heritage, but also feeling, you know, really special, that I have a unique point of view, you know, in the world.
The film is opening this month in the Philippines.
It is, yes. It'll be opening in theaters in Manila.
It's screened there before.
It has, yeah. We screened it at the Cinemalaya Film Festival and then and a couple community screenings.
What has the response been to the film there?
You know, a lot of people came to the screening and watched it thinking this is a document of their experience, because a lot of the people who saw it were, you know, at a lot of these protests, at a lot of these marches, events, you know, followed the story on television, on social media. So I think for them it was great to see something put together as, wow, this is, you know, not only does this document our experience, but it shows the growth of this movement. I think on another hand, some people were really intrigued by knowing that I'm Filipino-American, and knowing that there are people you know, with Filipino descent outside of the Philippines who are paying attention and wanting to contribute somehow, and feeling like there's more of a connection and solidarity there. That's been really great.
There's a lack of justice in many trans people's lives. If members of our community are killed every day, then there is no justice in the world.
One of the things that has been really moving is screening the film around the world. There have been a lot of mothers who have come up to me and saying, I can't imagine this happening to my child, you know? And it's not even a coming up to me and saying like, oh, I didn't know anything about, you know, the Philippines or something, you know, I didn't know anything about the trans community. It's very specifically about, oh, I cannot imagine the pain that this mother is going through, because just even the thought of losing my child is so horrific. And I think that really just exposes the human connection, you know, that everyone kind of has, regardless of, you know, all these, you know, regardless of all these things like race and gender and class. And, you know, at the core, we are all, you know, humans, and there is a human condition. And I think it kind of uncovers that.
Documentary director PJ Raval. His film, Call Her Ganda, is currently nominated for a GLAAD Media Award and will be airing on television in the U.S. later this year. PJ, thanks so much for being with us on This Way Out, and good luck at the awards.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you can find more information on the film and a schedule of upcoming screenings at callherganda.com. I'm Christopher Gall.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Wenzel Jones and Michael LeBeau, produced with Brian DeShazer, and from Christopher Gall. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Paul Bannon, Richard Merck, and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. You can join them by visiting thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email TWORadio on AOL.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KUR, Kutztown, Pennsylvania, WCBN, Ann Arbor, Michigan, Fresh FM, Nelson, Tasman, Eastern Golden Bay, and Blenheim, New Zealand, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
The studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. So much information is being kept under wraps. The public tries to gain access to some of it via Freedom of Information Act requests or other methods, but often those efforts fail or redactions make the documents actually obtained indecipherable. How did it get to be this way? What does state secrecy have to do with the effort to withhold information about the atom bomb? And what does Joseph Moscow mean when he asserts that official secrecy is a means of re-engineering and militarizing American society? Joseph Moscow is professor of anthropology at the University of Chicago, and his books include The Theater of Operations, National Security Affect from the Cold War to the War on Terror, and The Nuclear Borderlands, the Manhattan Project in Post-Cold War New Mexico. He has contributed a chapter about what he calls the security/threat matrix to the new volume, Bodies as Evidence, Security, Knowledge, and Power, edited by Mark McGuire, Ursula Rao, and Niels Zorowski. When Joseph Moscow joined me recently via Skype, I asked him what the Atomic Energy Act of 1946 did in terms of mandating that certain information be withheld from the U.S. public.
Contextualizing that act is important because coming out of 1945 and particularly the ending acts of World War II, the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki with an entirely new kind of technology that had been developed in secret over the previous couple years, and then announced to the world via those acts of city-ending kind of destruction, there is a very real question about what after World War II will become the basis for the management of not only nuclear science, but also the information around the bomb in particular. And what the Atomic Energy Act does in its first incarnation, and it's revised a few years later as well, is it establishes a new kind of information in the United States, a kind of information that is technically born secret, which means anything to do with that technology is assumed to be a classified matter until some official makes a formal legal effort to declassify it. And so what it does is it establishes at the center of the security state that is emerging after World War II, which is heavily invested in nuclear power, a secret state right at the center of science and technology and militarism. And it becomes the basis going forward for really thinking about state secrets not as strategic or technical matters, but as things that have potentially city-ending consequences for their revelation. And in the work that I've been doing, I've tracked over, you know, many decades how the idea of state secrecy becomes imbued with these affective charges around the idea that something that the state doesn't want to reveal becomes something that's immediately connected to something super destructive. And given the scope of the security state that emerges after 1945 and this kind of permanent secret state that's at the center of American democracy, this, I think, has huge implications for American society going forward.
And by affective, do you mean kind of on the emotional level?
Yeah, I do. And one of the most challenging aspects, I think, but most important aspects of nuclear politics in the United States is we tend to think of nuclear weapons as technologies and also things that are part of geopolitics. They are, you know, state-to-state relations, competitions. There was certainly, you know, 40 years of an arms race with the Soviet Union in which, like, each innovation in technological form really mattered. But I would argue that the primary role of nuclear weapons in American society has been emotional. It's been about constituting a notion of existential danger, of linking citizens to the state through that idea of an external totalizing danger, and then using it as a kind of point of negotiation and manipulation in terms of public perceptions of international affairs going forward. And pretty much kind of every decade from World War II going forward has a kind of formal nuclear scare that can be unpacked with this notion of emotional management at its center.
So the Atomic Energy Act of 1946, as you said, declared that nuclear weapons data was born classified, didn't have to be, as you said, formally classified after the fact. What did the National Security Act of 1947, so this is a year later, what did that law do to the, or vis-a-vis the secretive nature of U.S. government?
Yeah, it's part of this really incredibly substantial series of federal laws that really change how wartime and peacetime are organized in the United States. And we don't actually spend enough time just kind of attending to just what a kind of revolutionary series of decisions were being made in this immediate post-World War II moment. So a couple of things that happen over a series of kind of federal directives in the late 40s, the Department of War becomes the Department of Defense. So formally after World War II, the U.S. doesn't really declare war anymore. It's doing defense, and defense is increasingly imagined as global. So it puts a different valence on what military affairs are aimed at. And of course, it also requires a permanent mobilization, given that defense becomes now a de facto commitment of the state going forward. It's no longer based on dealing with a particular conflict, a particular enemy. And so, you know, we have lived since the late 40s in a world that is, in the United States, that is permanently mobilized and that maintains a large standing army that is involved in lots of covert and overt military actions around the world under this revised notion of defense. And at the very center of that, I would say that the atomic bomb plays just a huge role in that, not only because it becomes the basis for U.S. superpower status. And then a few years later, the Soviet Union enters into that status as well. So it creates a kind of hierarchy of states that have these kind of existential technologies. But it also, across the late 1940s and into the 1950s, one of the kind of formal federal projects was to think about how to mobilize the American public around nuclear danger and to create citizens that could now be remade as Cold War subjects that would support an emerging new kind of conflict against the Soviet Union known as Cold War, but that would also use the minute-to-minute danger of nuclear attack as a way to keep citizens kind of militarized and mobilized on behalf of the government. So that the era that folks of a certain generation remember as civil defense, in which there were, over the course of about 30, 40 years, daily exercises in public schools and a very engaged and deliberate and comprehensive propaganda effort to teach citizens to think about nuclear weapons in a particular way, to introduce them to images of nuclear destruction that were highly curated and designed to produce a certain kind of affective stance towards the bomb. That was very much at the center of the Cold War effort. It was a kind of domestic use of nuclear fear to support a geopolitical project that we think of now as the arms race with the Soviet Union. So the bomb is really crucial to understand as big science, as a project that gets the full support of the state for science and engineering, which has many, many overflowing effects across the disciplines. It's a big part of geopolitics in terms of creating a kind of hierarchy of states and also mobilizing existential danger through nuclear war as the basis for international relations. And then the least understood aspect of that is the role it plays in domestic politics in terms of creating a new citizen subject that is recruited by the state through civil defense, through mass media, to really think about the world, to think about nuclear danger, and to think about the power of the U.S. state in a very particular way.
But one could say that nuclear weapons data, data specifically relating to nuclear weapons, is one kind of information that a government might want to keep secret. You argue in this piece that the government wants to keep all kinds of information secret. And to what extent were linkages made, maybe explicitly or implicitly, by the government between kind of sensitive nuclear weapons data and data that had nothing to do with nuclear weapons, but somehow the government wanted to keep it under wraps?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. Thank you. And partly what we're talking about is the multi-decade kind of expansion of the logics of secrecy within the U.S. So in a simple way, we could think about it as during wartime, every state keeps secrets about what its military affairs are. It's part of the standard logic of warfare. But what happens after World War II is that there's a kind of permanent militarization of U.S. society, which installs then this deep and unprecedented in the U.S. commitment to secrecy around affairs. And that starts to accrue projects over time. And so the piece that we're talking about, as it enters into the 2000s and we have this kind of transformation from kind of Cold War dynamics around secrecy into counterterror dynamics around secrecy, we just see this really substantial explosion in the number of categories used in federal government that allow the restriction of information. Now, some of this occurs under extremely formal terms that are marked under a hierarchy of classifications that not only keep things secret, but also determine those who have classified access, what access they have to what material. And that has this historical formulation that is built up over many decades of Cold War. But there are also a series of other categorizations that I got very interested in, things that went for about a decade under the title sensitive but unclassified, kinds of material that were never formally designated as classified material, but that were treated by federal agencies as if they were.
Joseph Mosco is my guest. He's professor of anthropology at the University of Chicago. And his chapter about what he calls the secrecy slash threat matrix is part of a new volume called Bodies as Evidence, Security, Knowledge, and Power. Joe's chapter appears in expanded form in his book, The Theater of Operations, National Security Affect from the Cold War to the War on Terror. And you mentioned the sensitive but unclassified category, and I want to follow up with you, and I will, about that. But just to return to kind of earlier history, you know, the U.S. was the strongest military power in the world. And yet you are saying that the fear of nuclear weapons, nuclear attack was, of course, instilled in people through these civil defense exercises and through all the other information emanating from the government to the public. So how was this idea of atomic weapons, how did it square with the emphasis that appears to be the case of vulnerability of the U.S. to attack?
Yeah, it's a double-edged dynamic for sure. So even as the United States in the late 40s and into the early 50s has a gigantic kind of technical advantage in terms of the existing type of nuclear weapons that are part of the arsenal and the number, right away there is a counter-narrative about the vulnerability to future external nuclear states, with the eye on the Soviet Union in particular. And so this idea that nuclear power also comes with nuclear vulnerability is really structural to the post-World War II moment, and it creates, you know, a series of very substantial political commitments and institutions in the U.S. We could think actually about the reestablishment of the Department of Defense and the building out of the modern intelligence agencies, the creation of institutions like the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency in the early 1950s as deep structural commitments to trying to prevent a kind of surprise like the Pearl Harbor attack, but in a nuclear age. And running through the kind of formulation of this growth of intelligence agencies, which, you know, over 50 years grow to 17, 18 different, you know, highly classified agencies just devoted to intelligence, is this idea of the uncertainty of international affairs in a nuclear age and the incredible consequences for not understanding the dangers of nuclear war. So the modern kind of American national security apparatus, I think, has at its center a couple of linked projects. One is state secrecy and the way in which that functions, not only to manage domestic politics and perceptions of nuclear technologies, but also as just a kind of basic bureaucratic means of creating a hierarchy of subjects that have differential access to information around particularly defense-related technologies. So it's probably not known to many of your viewers that the way in which secrecy functions in the U.S. is that people with security classifications have need-to-know access. And so two people who work on nuclear weapon science, let's say, might have very different kinds of security clearances. They might be accessed to only interact with certain aspects of the technical side of weapon science and not others.
And this leads, as you write, to a kind of compartmentalization of information and of secrecy, with what consequences if some people in government know certain things because they have access to certain information and other people don't because they have access to other kinds of information?
Right. It sets up a dynamic that is very little understood in terms of even folks out of, my world in anthropology that write and think a lot about secrecy. In anthropology, one of the insights around secret societies, going back over 150 years of different kinds of assessments around the world, is that, you know, the content of the secret is less important than the social structural work that secrecy itself does, the way which it arranges people in terms of power, in terms of social access, in terms of political hierarchies.
Well, on that topic, what advice did Daniel Ellsberg of Pentagon Papers fame, what advice did he give to Henry Kissinger just before Kissinger became Secretary of State?
Yeah, this is a really serious quotation from Ellsberg's autobiography, in which, having had security clearances above top secret for the previous decade or so, and having worked very intensely on nuclear warfighting plans, Ellsberg is meeting with Kissinger to kind of tell him, as he's becoming national security advisor, what it will be like to finally get access to all the information that one imagines to be out there, but which, by virtue of one's prior clearance, one hasn't had access to. And he walks through a whole series of steps in which he says, you know, you're going to be exhilarated because finally, you know, there's no more barriers to knowledge and you're going to have access to everything. And then as you work through the various files that you now have clearance to read, you're going to start being really disappointed at the quality of the information that's in those files, because, you know, part of expectation is magnification. And you're going to find that the files aren't as complete as you like. The information is more dodgy or slippery than you'd like. And then Ellsberg starts to say that this is going to work on you for a while, and you're going to start meeting with people who have clearances that are lower than yours, and you're going to spend all of your time managing the structure of secrecy itself, trying to not give away what you know that the person you're meeting with isn't cleared to understand. And then also, secondarily, you're going to be asking yourself all the way through, if this person knew what I knew, had my clearances, would they be telling me the same thing that they're telling me? And then Ellsberg makes this kind of incredible comment. He just says, you're going to become something like a moron, because you're going to be unable to trust anybody, even those people that have much more technical expertise than you do in a given field, because you will be so tied to managing the system of classifications. And then Ellsberg concludes by saying, the only reason I can say this to you is because this is my experience, how I've interacted with people. This is my own kind of arc with having had no clearances to working up through the hierarchy to gaining many of the most sensitive clearances around nuclear weapons in particular.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Joseph Masco is my guest, M-A-S-C-O. He teaches anthropology at the University of Chicago. His books include The Nuclear Borderlands, The Manhattan Project in Post-Cold War in New Mexico, and The Theater of Operations, National Security Affect from the Cold War to the War on Terror. And part of what Joe argues in The Theater of Operations can be found in a chapter that he has contributed to a new volume. It's called Bodies as Evidence, Security, Knowledge, and Power. It's edited by Mark McGuire, Ursula Rao, and Nils Zorowski. It's published by Duke University Press. So your chapter in this text, Bodies as Evidence, invokes a term. It's called the secrecy threat matrix. And you've already begun to trace the contours of this term. Secrecy, I'm sure, relates to state secrecy, and threat relates, because I've read your piece, to the perceived threat posed by allowing sensitive information to get into the wrong hands or get out into the public. But can you tell us more about what you mean by the secrecy threat matrix?
Yes, I'd be happy to talk about the secrecy threat matrix concept, which is a way of thinking about the work of secrecy in the U.S. as through the Manhattan Project into the early Cold War period, it becomes supercharged with nuclear danger and becomes then the basis for the kind of prototypical state secret. So after World War II, we have an expanding set of institutions that are organizing themselves as secret agencies, a proliferation of intelligence agencies, a proliferation of defense agencies, a gigantic state bureaucracy, which is quite unprecedented for a democracy, which assumes that none of the activities of the world of defense and intelligence can be shared with citizens because there's danger attached to sharing, to transparency, and even in many most basic forms of accountability. And so I was thinking as I was reviewing this kind of long arc of the Cold War as it transforms in the early 2000s into the War on Terror, and was realizing that just one of the most profound effects of the nuclear revolution was to embed within the federal government a commitment to secrecy, but more than that, the kind of rhetorical and political commitment to the idea that every state secret is the equivalent of the nuclear secret, which means that the cost for revelation is not simply as it is in 99.9% of the matters of the state, a question of bureaucracy, a question of the day-to-day operations of a giant bureaucracy, but that there is some existential cost attached to transparency in the domain of the defense world and the intelligence world. And as the U.S. builds out a significant global infrastructure of military basing, of covert actions around the world, and a deep and abiding domestic commitment to nuclear weapons and other related technologies, we have a fundamental contradiction, I think, built into the democratic state form that resides in the nuclear revolution, which has to do with this notion that knowledge equals danger, that secrecy somehow protects the domestic order from some kind of existential event. And this has had a couple of very significant effects in terms of what we might just think of this as the social contract. One of them is that anybody who gets near state secrets is prosecuted. And so we have after late 1940s, early 1950s going forward, a new category of prosecution around a state secrets privilege, in which people who are bringing claims against the federal government or the military or a federal agency can have the case thrown out because the information in the accusation or in the litigation involves something that the state marks as a state secret. And so we have a long history now of very serious issues of public integrity, of questions of accidents and of unintended violence by defense organizations being tossed out of court simply because the state secret clause is evoked to disallow the hearing itself. In the early 2000s, this was used over and over again for a number of individuals who were picked up by CIA and related groups and subjected to forms of torture and then released under conditions that they were either misidentified or subjected to illegal treatment. And those cases have been thrown out of court simply because of the power of the state secret. So in the larger argument that I make in the book and the article, this tracks back to the conceptual power of linking existential danger in the form of nuclear weapons to state secrecy. And it's had, I think, a significant effect on modes of accountability in the U.S., but also just changing the social contract so that there are great domains of, you know, the most serious matters in the life of a country, and taking those away from citizen-state conversations at all under the logic of the state secret. So the secrecy threat matrix is a way of saying and also hopefully of alerting your listeners and people who hopefully read the book to the modalities of American life in which figures in elected office or through the Defense Department or through the intelligence agencies say essentially, we can't talk about this thing because it's too dangerous to talk about it, and to really interrogate those moments as profound moments of public manipulation and quite often misrecognition of what the actual terms, the political terms, the policy terms, the economic terms of those specific moments are actually about.
Joseph Mosco is his name, and he is author of, among other books, The Theater of Operations, National Security Affect from the Cold War to the War on Terror. We'll take a short break and speak more with Joe about his very interesting work. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Joseph Mosco is professor of anthropology at the University of Chicago. And we are talking about a chapter I came across about what he calls the secrecy slash threat matrix. It's part of a new volume. It's called Bodies as Evidence, Security, Knowledge, and Power. So we've talked to some degree about the Cold War and the emotion management, perception management campaign that was used by the U.S. government to, as you write and as you've kind of said, reprogram people, reprogram just U.S. residents as cold warriors. You write that it was about teaching people to fear the bomb and fusing that fear with anti-communism. Now, you've said a little bit about the war on terror, the more recent so-called war on terror. What did the George W. Bush administration do after 9/11 in the arena of government control over information?
Oh, yeah, it's a huge question. So in 2001, with the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, and the related set of anthrax mailings that were aimed at politicians and folks in the media, there was a very formal effort in the George W. Bush White House to think about how to re-energize and, in a sense, redirect the national security state to a new set of concerns, namely a figuration of a terrorist as a non-state actor, but also someone that could not be reasoned with and that was completely committed to doing mass violence. And under that configuration, there was a secondary project of looking back to the early Cold War state and thinking about how in the aftermath of World War II, and particularly after the Soviets' first nuclear test in 1949, how American society was mobilized around nuclear fear, and through both the creation of new federal agencies and new educational campaigns, particularly through civil defense, created what was known, you know, in political science and national security domains for a long time as the Cold War consensus, which had to do with a particular orientation towards geopolitics, a set of ideas about how those forms of anti-communism related to domestic politics fused with a deep multi-generational commitment to science and engineering, and particularly running continual Manhattan projects around military technologies.
So are you saying that the George W. Bush administration was looking for lessons from the past, what it could draw from Cold War strategies in terms of population management, perception management?
Yes, absolutely. And the crucial place to look for any of your listeners who kind of want to see the core text for understanding how radical the 2001 decisions are is to go to the authorization of force from late September 2001, which was signed by Congress and authorized the George W. Bush administration to not only send troops into Afghanistan to fight al-Qaeda and those that were attributed with the first round of 9/11 attacks. But also there's a crucial line in the authorization of force, which says that the president is authorized to use the capacities as commander in chief to prevent all future acts of terror. And that act is not bounded by time, by any particular enemy designation, and it also endows the president with the capacity to decide what is an act of terror and what should be the United States' response to it. And so basically since 2001, most military activities around the world, and the U.S. has been involved all around the world, literally, and has troops in many, many different countries and special forces and many more, using that authorization of force as an effort to prevent any notion of future terror. And so in a sense, that 2001 authorization of force creates the future itself as the problem that needs to be managed. And it creates a notion of counterterror that is endless. It also creates a form of war that can't be won, because if you think about this in a kind of literal way, when can terror be eliminated from the human experience? And it suggests that the entire existential concept that was established during the Cold War kind of nuclear danger has been reformatted for this new kind of conflict. And so absolutely in 2001, 2002, Bush administration officials are literally reading the policy guidance and the debates of the late 40s and 1950s and are thinking about how to build a counterterrorist state that could be as long-lasting as the Cold War state. And there are direct parallels.
Yeah, and this must have created quite an urgency on their part to protect information, to keep information about terror operations or terror possibilities from the public. What happened to the rate at which records over 25 years old were declassified?
It's a really important story, and partly we'd need to back up a little bit to the really unusual moment of the mid-1990s when the U.S. for the first time wasn't formally at war, and the Soviet Union had, of course, dissolved. And there was a widespread effort, particularly also because of the innovation of the internet, to do declassification and to think about opening up federal archives that were closed under all sorts of secrecy restrictions for the public good, for democracy, for scholarship, and so on. And so there is a few years really in the mid 1990s where quite a lot of historical material, mostly over 50 years old, certainly over 25 years old, were declassified, and it significantly contributed to changes in the scholarship of U.S. politics, U.S.-Soviet relations in the second part of the 20th century. What the 9/11 event does, and the decisions of the Bush administration afterwards, is to suggest that information once again becomes a fundamental danger to the state and needs to be protected. In October of 2001, John Ashcroft, then as Attorney General, sends out a notice to all federal agencies to essentially slow down Freedom of Information Act requests and wherever possible to resist participating in the Freedom of Information Act law as part of a general strategy of slowing down and restricting information across the federal government. A related aspect of this, which is really extremely hard to kind of account for, is also the technological revolution that is happening in information technologies, not just the internet, but also social media. And one of the large-scale information gathering projects centered through agencies like the National Security Agency around counterterror measures is to think about digital information itself now as something that could be collected increasingly in a comprehensive way to create, you know, historical depth and data archives, and also to be able to link how pretty much every individual that has access to a computer or a cell phone or a credit card exists in global data. And related to that, there are a whole series of new theories about what data is and how it can be used in comprehensive forms, collecting across many different sources to do strategic kind of work that informs a general reluctance across federal agencies to be open and transparent in ways that just a decade earlier were quite normal and accepted and even enthusiastically embraced as part of a democratic society.
You spoke earlier about the sensitive but unclassified category of information. This is information removed from public circulation as if it were classified. So this is a kind of a new, right, sensitive but unclassified. It's a new category. When was this category created, and what guidelines are in place to help federal agencies make the determination of whether a certain piece of information is sensitive but unclassified?
Yes. Well, it's quite a story. And part of it goes back to the 1980s and a fellow named John Poindexter, who at that point was part of the Reagan administration and was also tied up in the Iran-Contra scandal. But he had the idea of creating a set of protocols around government information that created categories for restricting the circulation. And some of that had to do with commercial matters, things that might be subject to patents. Some of it had to do with just privacy matters around personnel. But crucially, what it sets in motion is it offers each federal agency the opportunity to decide how to treat the non-classified information that is running through their computers and their various file systems. And it starts a process of building an increasing number of categories and ways in which information that might have circulated easily in a public domain become increasingly restricted. And the crucial bit about the category is that it's not subject to the federal laws around classified information. It's a kind of separate domaining of state information and a way of restricting its circulation.
So people can't challenge the designation of a certain piece of information as sensitive but unclassified?
It becomes increasingly difficult, and whereas in the Freedom of Information Act or FOIA domains, people can ask for an explanation for why a given piece of information wasn't provided under the guidelines of that law and can also appeal. The sensitive but unclassified designation had no such apparatus around it. And it also allowed, you know, each agency to create its own parallel logics of what constituted sensitive information. And that's the crucial thing to attend to here, that sensitive isn't defined by federal law. It is a general category in which, you know, agencies can make their own determinations. And so this rides on top of the formal classification system that has existed back to World War II that has a set of criteria, laws, logics of adjudication around them. And what's happened in the last few years is an effort to go around to federal agencies that started in the Obama years to try to actually just systematize even the terms that different federal agencies are using that evoke the concept of sensitive but unclassified, to try to systematize and come up with a overarching kind of logic across federal agencies. But in general, one of the very profound effects of the war on terror has been a general restriction on the circulation of state information and increasing use of litigation, as well as versions of the sensitive but unclassified concept to restrict public access.
Joseph Mosco joins me. He is professor of anthropology at the University of Chicago. We're talking about a chapter he contributed to the new volume, Bodies as Evidence, Security, Knowledge, and Power. And that chapter by Joe appears in expanded form in his book, The Theater of Operations, National Security Affect from the Cold War to the War on Terror. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Secrecy is also a fundamental part of U.S. covert operations. Chalmers Johnson wrote about covert operations. What did he say about what those operations, which are kept secret by definition from the U.S. public, what they do to the intelligibility, to the U.S. public's ability to make sense of actions taken in response to those covert operations, say abroad?
Yeah, it's a really serious point that Chalmers Johnson makes. I mean, he kind of began this argument by counting up the number of U.S. military bases around the world. And depending on what you decide is a military base, you know, it's somewhere between 800 and 1,000 outside the United States. So this is, you know, he notices is a completely unprecedented global project of garrisoning the planet in a way. And connected to all those bases are, of course, not only troops, but also special operations forces. I think as of 2017, the Costs of War Project at Brown College, part of the Watson Institute, documented that U.S. had special forces in some 130 nations around the world. And what Johnson says is that he turns to the CIA concept of blowback as a way to also think about the long-term consequences of covert militarism for American political culture.
Right, and blowback is kind of the phenomenon of retaliating, of others retaliating against the U.S. for what the U.S. has done.
Exactly. And what Johnson says is that there's two aspects to the concept of blowback. One is that there's retaliation to some kind of U.S. Militarism, counterterrorism, covert action. And the crucial secondary bit, which isn't as well understood or talked about, is that because of the way secrecy functions in the domestic politics of the United States, those initial actions by U.S. agents are never publicized at home. And so there is no context for understanding the terms of a retaliation against U.S. militarism abroad in some way. And what that creates then is, from a domestic American point of view, the idea that the world is irrational, that there are entities out there that are committing forms of violence that have no relationship to ongoing U.S. activities, that there's no interaction between, you know, this kind of extraordinary U.S. Militarism abroad and local politics, that the world is kind of unknowable and hyper-violent. And that fits very comfortably within the definition of counterterror as defined by the George W. Bush administration. In a world that is hyperviolent and unknowable, one needs all sorts of militarized reactions to that. And that was one kind of definitional logic of the emerging counterterror state after 2001. So for Chalmers Johnson, democracy is deformed by the way secrecy prevents an understanding of what U.S. is doing around the world in both overt and covert ways, and makes the world less and less intelligible over time, and invites arguments for ever greater militarization in an effort to protect the United States from these perceived forms of irrational violence that in fact have connections to ongoing U.S. activities abroad.
So as we wrap up here, I want to come back, Joe, to this argument you are making that secrecy has ubiquitous effects, that nobody is immune from the distorting effects of U.S. state secrecy. You said earlier that U.S. society is becoming implicitly militarized. What do you mean by that, and how do you want to kind of sum up your sense of how the residents of the U.S. are affected by this overwhelming context of secrecy, the effort by the U.S. to keep information out of the public's hands?
Well, we're speaking in 2019, so we're 18 years into the war on terror. The U.S. has fought a series of wars in Afghanistan and Iraq that have been widely critiqued as military debacles. They've been hyper-violent affairs that have not produced democratic orders as promised within those states and have had huge, huge casualty counts. And I refer everybody again to the Watson Institute at Brown University's Cost of War Project, which is an effort to do a kind of real-time just accounting for the costs of war in terms of dead and injured, in terms of money, in terms of refugee status. And the U.S. has been involved in just really an extraordinary act of global violence over the last two decades in retaliation for the 9/11 attacks, quite formally. And we don't have at any point really in American society right now, a consideration, a detailed discussion, an evaluation of the cost of the decision-making, the moral responsibility for violence on that scale, let alone an effort to think about the next decade of counterterror, because there is no end in sight for this notion of a really global scale deployment of American power on behalf of preventing terrorist acts in the future. And we also have a military budget in this country that grows with each year, with not only no accountability for how that money has been spent, but also any of the activities of that vast set of agencies and interests and technologies over time. I think that the long-term effects of the secrecy threat matrix on American society is to freeze out a robust democratic debate about militarism. And if the U.S. government is committed to permanent war, and there is not a robust civilian debate about what it authorizes its federal government to do in its name, then there is a serious deformation of democratic politics. And I think it's high time and an important project for everybody to think about what are the institutions that create that dynamic. Some of those are at the federal government level. Some of those happen at the level of affect and management and the way in which fears of the future and fears of imminent violence are constituted and transmitted. Some of them have to do with the imaginaries of, you know, what the future dangers are and deep structural problems in American political life around race and ethnicity that are highly challenging to talk about, but that are at the core of counterterror programming. And so the question of how you maintain a militarized society that runs military bases all over the world, that has special forces involved in most states around the world, that also maintains the state-of-the-art nuclear arsenal and maintains the capacity to threaten the rest of the world in terms of nuclear danger, while also saying it's not a militarized society, that it's not committed to imperialist projects, that it is doing this only under the name of kind of necessary defense, is one of the most important conversations I think that the country needs to have. And it's extremely challenging to have a robust conversation around these themes, which is one of the great reasons that I'm happy to be on Against the Grain today, precisely because we get to have this chance. So I'm grateful to UCS for inviting me to be on.
Well, I'm grateful for your insights. Joseph Masco, again, M-A-S-C-O. You can read more about his insights into secrecy and threat in the Theater of Operations, National Security Affect from the Cold War to the War on Terror, which is one of Joe's books. And I found a chapter he wrote for the new volume, Bodies as Evidence, Security, Knowledge, and Power. Thanks so much, Joe, for your work and for joining us.
It's my great pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Many thanks to Kirsten Thomas, who's at the controls today.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. your online antidote to corporate media crap.